Hello. Welcome to the second session of the 2011 annual town meeting. I call this meeting to order as we now have a quorum, and I so declare. My name hasn't changed. It's still Myron Fox, and I'm still privileged to be your moderator. And I need two volunteers. The Boy Scouts, who generally run the mics, were unable to make it tonight. So I need one person there with a mic and one person there with a mic. Do I have two volunteers, or do I'm going to end up choosing them? Yes, thank you. And ma'am, thank you. Patty, would you give them instructions? Could the lady with the straight hair come down here in front? Okay. Coffee and snacks tonight are being provided by the 6th Grade Cadet Girl Scout Troop 77171, which does an extensive amount of community service work. Again, please turn off all your cell phones and any other devices that make an audible noise. Please give your name and address clearly each time you speak in order to assure an accurate record of the proceedings. And please do not lower the mic while you're speaking away from your face, because then we won't be able to hear you. All motions to amend must be delivered to me, the town clerk, and the folks at the Viewgraph in writing before they are made. Only registered voters of the town and non-resident town employees and may speak without leave of the hall. Non-residents are required to sit in the last two rows to my right and left. I remind the hall and presenters that each presenter has a maximum of 10 minutes, and the timer will ring at 5 minutes for everyone's information. Speakers have a maximum of 5 minutes, unlike presenters. Please do not feel compelled to use all of your allotted time. Try the Abe Lincoln two-minute approach. Abe did pretty good with it. A reminder that there'll be no hissing, booing, whistling, clapping, or the like before, during, or after the time someone is speaking. Speakers may not make disrespectful comments, whether directed at a speaker, presenter, or town official. I am encouraging those of you who don't speak very often at town meeting or not at all to speak. Be sure to look at the fine artwork by Ellis students located in the lobby. It's the 16th celebration, Celebrate Arts Week. Also, someone mentioned to me earlier this evening that there was a lot of trash left after we left the hall. So I would please ask that you take your warrants and your other papers and trash with you at home so that others don't have to do it for you. Does anybody not have a warrant? Raise your hand if you do not have a warrant and wish to have one. Oh, it's so wonderful. The second night, everybody has their warrant. Also, if you're interested in any materials about warrant articles, there's a table outside the auditorium. And bathrooms are across the hall from the auditorium. And emergency exits are through the two back doors and through the two stairways in the front of the auditorium. I get that right, Chief? All right. Article 6, Bob Stein of the Finance Committee to make a motion.
Move to appropriate the sum of $290,390 for the Transfer Station Enterprise Fund for fiscal year 12, and further to authorize the use of an additional $33,146 of enterprise fund receipts for indirect costs, such sums to be raised by $323,536 in receipts of the enterprise.
Okay, and I assume the only difference between that and what's in the warrant is that you now have the numbers. That is correct. Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Stein.
FinCom recommends approval.
Great. Mr. O'Brien.
Board of Selectmen supports.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 6? Yes, sir. Can we pass him the mic? I don't think it's on.
Moderator.
Now
it's
on.
Robert Abrams, 48 Horse Pond Road. A couple of questions. One question is whether or not anybody can explain to me what the difference is between an enterprise fund under this article and a revolving fund under some other articles we have coming up. That's one question.
Well let's start there.
Okay.
Town manager have an answer for that?
I'll try, and I think the finance director will supplement if I have it wrong. They are just different mechanisms set under state law. The enterprise fund has to have all of its expenses fully appropriated. It's meant to run like a business and is used where the fees generated should support the operation. You generally find it with things like solid waste, water, sewer, recreation, a few items like that. The revolving fund, on the other hand, also collects fees, but those don't need to be appropriated each year. The total just needs to be authorized. Under an enterprise fund, typically the employees of that department are fully charged to that that fund, not so under a revolving fund.
Thank you. My other question under this article is whether you can tell us how much there is in retained earnings in this enterprise fund now, and how much there will be in retained earnings if we after this fiscal year if we pass this article. Thank you.
Is that in the warrant?
I don't believe the accumulated retained earnings balance is in there. Do you have that, Bill?
There's a column marked retained earnings used.
Right. That's the amount we take out of it used to support the budget. The finance staff here is pulling that up to take a look at that.
Okay. Mr. Abrams, we're going to move on and get back to that answer when they find it. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 6? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Please stand. It's already on.
Thank you, sir. Dandy Pompey, 35 Haynes Road. I have a question that basically follows up on what Mr. Abrams just asked. Can you address some of these wild fluctuations in receipts? And it looks to me like basically the tax levy has funded this enterprise in the last couple of years, and next year it looks like they will be fully self-sufficient. Is that a correct interpretation?
Town manager.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. It has not been supported by the tax levy in any way, shape, or form over the past, I don't know how many years, so I'd have to look and see. I have been informed that the retained earnings balance at the beginning, or that we have at this point, is $149,000. And at the end of FY12, if this goes through, we are planning on adding to that by about $6,400. You can see from the warrant, we're planning on having that as a excess after the fees support the cost of it. As to the fluctuation in the fees, I don't know if DPW Director Bill Place, do you have anything in terms of why the actuals went from 290 to 328? Between FY9 and FY10?
There was a slight increase in the ticket fees, and there was additional participation in the actual ticket fees themselves from residents of the town.
I believe, Bill, if I'm correct, that somewhere along that is when we were also having success in the sale of our recyclables, and those came in as receipts, and we did see in the last 18 months, the exact period, we're not getting the money on the recyclables anymore. So that also affected as part of the receipts.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes?
Just to follow up, Mr. Moderator, so that I understand. I understand the concept that if the budget's going to be 323,536, and if the anticipated revenue is going to be 330,000, I understand conceptually that the retained earnings in this fund will increase approximately $6,400. Now, the way that this is written, we have $33,000 in indirect cost that was appropriated, I think, last night in the benefits budget. If the revenue from the transfer station covers everything and $6,400 surplus goes into retained earnings, does that mean that the $33,000 that's shown as appropriated from the benefits budget never actually comes out of the benefit budget? And if it doesn't come out of the benefits budget, where does it end up? Does it go back in the general fund, or does the benefits budget just also have some extra money left over for a future use?
For the $33,000 that you see under the line item, indirect costs in your warrant on this budget, that money will be transferred from the enterprise fund to the benefits budget to pay those costs. So this enterprise fund will pay those costs, and they are shown here to show the total costs of running this enterprise. There's no excess. And it happened through the motion. You may have six pages of motion for the Article 4 last night, but all of that language included in there is making this transfer happen.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 6? I see no one. All those in favor of Article 6, everyone sees it, the motion, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It is a unanimous vote. On to Article 7. Mr. Stein of the Finance Committee will make the motion.
Move to appropriate the sum of $517,230 for the Pool Enterprise Fund for fiscal year 12, such sum to be raised from $480,000 in receipts of the enterprise and use of retained earnings of $37,230 of the enterprise, and to further authorize the use of an additional $62,542 appropriated under account 900, fiscal 12 town employee benefits for indirect costs.
Does it receive a second? It does. Mr. Stein?
FinCom recommends approval.
Selectman Hardy?
Board of Selectmen supports this article.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 7? I see no hands. All those in favor of the motion, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? I see no one opposed. It's unanimous. We're going to move on to Article 8. Mr. Stein.
Move to appropriate the sum of $309,614 from the Recreation Field Maintenance Enterprise Fund, Fiscal 12, such sum to be raised from $309,614 in receipts of the enterprise.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Stein?
The Finance Committee, unanimous support for this bill.
Selectman Hardy?
Board of Selectmen supports this article.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 8? I see no one. All those in favor of the motion, signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It's yet another unanimous vote. Article 9. Who is making the motion under Article 9? Barbara Chisholm, our town accountant. The motion is on the view graph up there.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move to indefinitely postpone consideration of Article 9.
Does that receive a second? It does. Ms. Chisholm?
There are no unpaid bills.
That's a good reason.
Yep.
Anybody wish to be heard on why we don't have any unpaid bills? Okay. All those in favor, signify your raising your cards. Those opposed? Wow. A unanimous vote. Number 10 has already been passed unanimously in the consent calendar. Ditto with 11. We are now on Article 12. Our Finance Director, Andrea Turkelson, will make a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move in the words of the article.
Receive a second. It does. Ms. Turkelson?
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Revolving funds hold receipts from a specific revenue source that are accounted for separately from the general fund and may be spent without further appropriation to support the activity, program, or service generated from the revenue. State law allows for several types of revolving funds. Tonight, we're here asking you to consider only our 53E and a half revolving funds. Spending from the funds that fall under Massachusetts General Law, Chapter 44, Section 53E and a half, shall be annually authorized at town meeting, and that's what brings us here tonight for Article 12. Generally, revolving funds are established where there is a group of people or entities in the town who desire a service or are regulated under a bylaw of the town, and the town and SPS can determine and collect a fee to support the service. In doing so, taxpayers don't have to support the service or program area. The users or beneficiaries pay directly via the fees that are set. Revolving funds have allowed some services to continue that used to be covered by the general fund, but no longer are. One example would be in the teen center. Revolving funds also allow the town to begin offering new services that are desired by the town. In a most recent case, that would be our passport processing. Article 12 is an omnibus request for all the town and school revolving funds under 53E and a half that are being brought to you asking for a reauthorization. In other words, they're not new this year. We're just asking for you to reaffirm or reauthorize the spending limits for the next fiscal year. Each year, the boards, departments, and officers in charge of these revolving funds submit their requests at town meeting for the spending limits for the coming year. Revolving funds, along with all the other funds of the town, are subject to annual audit and full reporting to the Department of Revenue. No board, department, or officer shall be authorized to spend under its direct control more than 1% of the most recent certified tax year levy. All of the revolving funds in total cannot exceed 10% of the town's annual tax levy. All of these financial requirements are complied with each year. Last night, there was a question regarding a specific section of the Massachusetts Law 53E and a half. It had to do with reporting requirements. We've put that up on the board here so that everybody can see what was being talked about last night. And it does talk about having the town or the different departments involved in the revolving funds reporting annually to the town various balances for the prior fiscal year and the last 6 months. There was a little discussion back and forth, and wanted to mention that approximately half the departments that have revolving funds that are being asked for tonight have actually reported that financial information in the annual town report. We haven't, as a habit, included that information in the town warrant, but have tried to do that in the annual report that comes out every year around this time as well. Those that did not report in this past fiscal year had to do with some of the newer revolving funds that have been established. What we'd like to say is that the town and the SPS boards and officers will be requested to make sure that they report that information every year in the annual town report, and to be a little clearer and more obvious with the information for town meeting, I'll make sure that we include that summary information in next year's town warrant along with the omnibus request. Since there was some question regarding the information, revenues and expenses for the prior year, as mentioned in the statute, I did pull together a spreadsheet for you if there's anybody that has any specific questions on the different items that are being requested tonight. We've got that information available to you. And with that, I would just like to close with a rendition of the information that's in the article, in your warrant for Article 12, and ask that you consider appropriating everything that's been asked for tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Chuck Woodard of the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee supports this article.
Bob Hardy for the Selectmen.
Board of Selectmen supports this article.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 12? Gentleman to your right.
Mr. Moderator, I move to amend Article 12.
No, you don't.
I don't?
Got to give it to me first.
Yes, sir. I didn't want to come up there before I told you I was coming.
Nope. I've conferred with counsel. Your first paragraph is okay. That's fine to make that amendment. The second paragraph is outside the four corners of the article, so you cannot make that. And the third one is contrary to statute, so you can't make that either. But you can make that first paragraph. So, Mark, did you hear what I said?
Yes.
So if you can put the first paragraph on the view graph, or you can put all three, but cross out paragraphs 2 and 3. I just put the first paragraph on.
Point of order. I believe that notwithstanding that you ruled out the second and third paragraph, we should see all three. We should see what it is.
We should see what it is that you're ruling out of order.
That's not a valid point of order, Mr. Coe. You may be seated. Mark?
Yep.
Put all three on the screen. Mr. DePompei, would you please read us the first paragraph of your amendment?
Yes, sir. This paragraph is meant to simply be added. It's not to change
right. The
other wording. The first paragraph is, the board, department, or officer.
I'm sorry. Why don't you start by saying, I move to amend by adding.
I move to amend Article 12 by adding the following wording. The board, department, or officer of each revolving fund, parentheses, funds, will report to the annual town meeting the total amount of receipts and expenditures for each revolving fund under its control for the prior fiscal year, current fiscal year, estimated, and the next fiscal year, estimate.
Two things. Would you consider crossing off the apostrophe in its?
Yes, sir, I will.
Okay. And secondly, where would you like to put this, at the beginning, at the end, in the middle, somewhere? Move in the words of the article.
It can be put at the end.
Fine. Let's leave it at that. So you move to amend to insert this paragraph at the end of the motion.
At the end of the motion, yes, sir.
Great. Terrific. Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. DePompei, tell us why we should vote for it.
If you sum up the revolving funds, you'll find that the revolving funds are right around $1 million, which is about the same as the enterprise funds. And we do them as revolving funds, I think sometimes just because it's more convenient to do them as revolving funds rather than enterprise funds. However, the accounting requirements are really the same. And all I'm asking for is that just as we look at the accounting of the enterprise funds in the town report, we have the same opportunity to look at the revolving funds in the town report, which is not only a document that's current, but it's going forward. The town warrant, which I think is a great document, is a record of what happened in the past. I'm really more interested, I think the past is the past. I'm more interested in the current time and what we estimate going forward. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Okay, let's hear from town manager.
I guess I would just say just a couple of points to that. As you can see, the third item is asking that earnings in it at the end of fiscal year will be applied to it, and that is one of the differences perhaps I should have mentioned earlier between enterprise and a revolving fund. Under the enterprise, they do stay with it. The revolving fund, all interest earned on those, it's not tracked that way, but it does go to the general fund, and that is set by statute. We can't put anything in to the opposite of that. One of the things I should just mention that people should be aware of on revolving funds, they're meant to give a huge amount of flexibility. So, for instance, the Recreation Department or the Council on Aging, if they want to change a program they offer and it's a two-week program and they want to bring it in, they didn't have to plan that 6 months in advance like an enterprise fund. There you run a very programmed, forecast, straight program. There's not a lot of flexibility in it. You have your business plan. Revolving funds are meant to have just a lot of flexibility under starting a program, ending a program, doing all of that. As long as they stay within the cap that town meeting has set, they bring in enough money to pay for it. It's a very flexible way of dealing with and giving that kind of, you know, ability to areas like the Recreation and Council on Aging to do programming, to do things like that. So the state laws really did set them up for different purposes. I believe for enterprise, they actually are articulated what can be set up for an enterprise fund. For instance, we looked at trying to do a couple of other things under an enterprise fund, and the town finance director looked and said, that's not allowed under the state statute to do that as an enterprise fund. Those are very much limited for set specific items. So revolving funds are sort of the catch-all at the end. If you're going to say, like with the school bus funds, pay the fee and we pay the bus company. No more complicated than that. It just passes through. So it's a different mechanism for that. I'm just trying to clarify some of that information about the revolving fund.
Does the Board of Selectmen have an opinion on the amendment, either for or against?
The first paragraph or the whole thing?
We're talking about the first paragraph only. Correct. That's the amendment. And the FinCom, you're correct. You're the next on the hit parade. Anybody else while we're waiting for them wish to be? Yes, sir.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Mr. Moderator, we're talking about something that none of us can see. We're discussing even the spelling, even whether an apostrophe. We can't see any of it. Am I blind?
Thank you for your comment, Mr. Coe. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, ma'am. Standing there? Behind you. Yeah, no, you. Yes.
Barbara Pryor, 221 Knobscott Road. I'm also a trustee of the Goodnow Library, and I do want to talk a little bit about the flexibility of the revolving fund. If you look at the amount that is in the town warrant for the library, it's only $10,500 maximum. We collect no more than $3,500 probably to $5,000 a year. But the thing is that it does give us some flexibility in spending something that comes up unexpectedly. For example, we had some damage to our audiovisual equipment last year due to some electrical failures in the library. The result was that some of that was paid for by insurance, but we were able to use monies from the revolving fund, or we could have used monies from the revolving fund if we wanted, and we did go ahead and update that audiovisual equipment. If we had to guess what we were going to spend our money on, either a current year or a future year, we never would have been able to guess that we were going to have an electrical failure, and we could use some of the money if we wanted to update that kind of equipment. So I just want to echo the fact that, at least in our case, the revolving fund gives us some flexibility, and we can't always anticipate what the costs are that we might use it for.
Hang on. Does the FinCom now have an opinion on the amendment, which is the first paragraph on the view graph?
Specific to the first paragraph, assuming there isn't an extra burden, we're fine with this this amendment.
Okay. And have the selectmen reached a position?
The selectmen support the amendment.
Okay. So I guess, Mr. DePompei, you don't want to speak any further. Oh, good lawyers always stop talking when they win.
I'm aware of that. I just want to make a comment on the library. I certainly have no difficulty with these funds that are in the $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 range. My concern just gets to the point to where you might have one or two funds that are 95% of the total revolving fund sum. And I appreciate the fact that the revolving fund says you don't have to plan quite as thoroughly, but I think when your fund gets to be $500,000, it would be appropriate to plan what is happening. Thank you, Mr. Moderator.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 12? Yes, please stand. And, Roger, if you come around front and just hand him the mic. Thank you.
Jan Hudberg, 715 Mock Road. If I read this amendment correctly, then at town meeting we're going to have to hear from each of the board, department, or officer of each of the revolving funds. Is that what this amendment is proposing?
You mean will they have to speak at town meeting for each of these amounts?
Yeah.
It could be a handout. It could be something that's printed in the warrant. They don't necessarily have to make a presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
As I read this, it's just a report. Is that what you had in mind? Is that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, no. Paragraphs two and
paragraphs 2 and 3 are not included in the amendment, so you can leave them on the board and just make them lighter than everything else. So everyone understands. Well, actually, you've had time to read the second and third paragraphs. Okay, just make them lighter. We're only voting on the first paragraph. That is the amendment. And it did receive a second, correct? Yes, it does now. Okay. I see no other hands on the amendment. We're only voting on the amendment now. All those in favor of the amendment signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, the amendment carries by more than a majority. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 12? Yes. Yeah. They're gonna be doing that. In the word "its," I-T-S, just eliminate the apostrophe. But that's already passed. That's okay. We'll eliminate the apostrophe, because that was the amendment. Anybody else wish to be heard? We're now on the main motion for Article 12. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 12? I see no hands. All those in favor of Article 12, the motion signify with the amendment. This is the main motion with the amendment, signify by raising cards. All those opposed, it passes by well more than a majority. We are now on to Article 13. Larry O'Brien, Selectman, will make the motion.
Moving the words of the article, Mr. Moderator.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you. Debbie Dineen will be presenting.
Ms. Dineen is the Conservation Coordinator for the Town of Sudbury.
Good evening, and thank you for that introduction, Mr. Moderator. I'm here to propose yet another revolving fund. This was originally on the consent calendar, and it was held. Unlike the library and how the library uses its funds for unforeseen expenses, the Conservation Commission is looking to generate some funding to use to keep trails on our conservation lands open to the public and safe for public use. The Commission currently manages almost 800 acres of land, that have public trails throughout these areas. In FY11, we had a grand total of $711 to manage the trails. It's budget cuts. It's what has happened. We had requested $7,500 because trail maintenance has been deferred. If you've been out to any of our trails over the past couple of years, you'll notice that they're starting to get grown in. The bridges are starting to rot a bit. The budgeted amount has been down from $3,000, which was appropriated in FY04 through FY09. In FY010, we were reduced to about $1,400. The Commission has been actively seeking volunteers, including scouts, and using them whenever possible, as well as securing grant funding to work on our conservation lands. We've received grants for 100% of the preparation of forest management plans for our Libby, King Philip, Haynes, Knobscot, and Hot Brook conservation areas, and Piper conservation areas. By getting a grant to do these plans, we became eligible for some additional grants, of which we've received about another $3,500 to actually get out and do some work. If you've been out to the King Philip land recently, you may have noticed that some of the old historic stone walls are now beginning to be cleared out. You can see some of the old stone foundations and structures. We have a problem out there with invasive plants. And in order to get rid of the invasive plants, we have to use herbicide. The Commission doesn't want to use herbicide. We have to use a special herbicide. We have to cut the plant and paint in each individual stem. That takes a long time and also needs a certified pesticide applicator. But it's the only way to keep these old stone walls intact for future generations. That costs money, which we have gotten all grants to do this. We have also, we have an application into the state for another $14,000 for trail clearing improvements, handicapped accessible trailhead, and trail in King Philip. We don't know if we'll be successful with that until the end of the summer. We've applied for just under $15,000 in state funding for reconstruction of the trail system, including the bridges and boardwalks in the well-used Hop Brook conservation land. It was announced that we would be awarded this grant, but then with the state cutbacks, our $14,000 went down to $4,500. So you'll see that we have tried to get funding from any possible revenue source that we can. But yet, for the first time since 1962, which is when the town acquired its first conservation land, we have had to close trails as of last year. And there it is behind us, because we just don't have the funds to fix those bridges in that conservation land. That's the Hop Brook conservation land. There are about four areas that look just like that. And we have had to, unfortunately, close it because we lack of funding. Therefore, when we went to our budget hearings with the town finance director and town manager this year, we were trying to get creative in a way that we could get some funding. The Conservation Commission does lease eight fields to farmers in town. And as part of that, up to this point, we have looked at in-kind services, which means if we need the community gardens plowed, if we need to get compost, if we need cart roads fixed, if we need new drainage put in, we can call on these farmers to do the work for us. But now that the budgets are getting very tight, we are going to need to generate some additional funding for trail maintenance. What we're looking at in terms of funding is not a windfall. We lease about 52 acres of fields a year, over the course of eight fields. The average rental for a field in this area is somewhere between $50 and $100 an acre. If we assume $75 an acre, that's only $3,600. That's not even half of what we need, but it's a start. It will allow us to continue to keep the major trails open and keep them safe. So I urge your support, and I will be happy to answer any other questions.
Okay. Chuck Woodard for the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee supports this article.
And Mr. O'Brien, I assume the Selectmen support this since they made the motion?
Correct, Mr. Moderator.
Thank you. Anyone wish to be heard on Article 13? Yes.
Mr. Moderator, Robert Abrams, 48 Horse Pond Road. I'd like to bring a motion to amend up to the podium.
Yes.
You have one for the view graph person?
Could you come here, Mr. Abrams? I just had a couple questions for you. What's that? Hang on one second. Ms. Deneen? Thank you. We were talking with counsel and the person, Mr. Abrams, who made the amendment, and the amendment was basically to change this revolving fund into an enterprise fund. And although as much as we looked at and see if we could allow this amendment, we cannot. And the reason is because in an enterprise fund, there's a user fee. And with these conservation trails, according to Ms. Dineen, some of them were purchased with state money for which you cannot charge a user fee. Therefore, we couldn't put this into an enterprise fund, according to council, and therefore the amendment cannot be allowed, just to let the hall know. Does anybody else wish to be heard on Article 13? Please stand up wherever you are.
Don Charles, 92 Blueberry Hill Lane. I just have a broader question about trail maintenance. I know that SVT, on SVT lands, much of the trail maintenance is done by volunteers, and also a lot of the building of little bridges and things like that are also done by volunteers. My question is whether the Conservation Commission uses that for conservation lands, and why, whether it's possible to have much of the maintenance done for free.
Ms. Dineen.
Yes, thank you for asking that. Yes, we do. We rely solely on volunteers right now to do labor. We utilize the scouts. We are on a list with the Eagle Scouts. All of the scout masters have a list of our upcoming projects, and we work routinely with the scouts and with volunteers. Some of the scouts, particularly not the Eagle Scout projects, they like to build things, but they don't have the funding to buy materials. So most of our kiosks have been built by scouts, the actual labor, but we still have to purchase the materials. Volunteers can do a lot, but again, they can't purchase the materials. They can't purchase any of the parking lot signs. They can't purchase the wood, the nails, the cement foundations that we use, the pin foundations that we use through sensitive areas. That's something that we have to come up with, and that's exactly what these funds are for, so we can get more volunteers and scouts out there. Last year we had the major bridge collapse over Hop Brook. The town purchased the materials, and a number of user groups came in and actually over the course of 3 or 4 days completely rebuilt the bridge with no charge to the town. They provided all the labor. So that's what this fund will be about, mostly to purchase materials so that volunteers can get out there and do the labor. The only labor that we pay for is for a licensed pesticide applicator in only very, very specific situations.
So you do have a regular volunteer for each trail?
We do not. We have been advertising in the paper for volunteers. We work very closely with a group called SWEET, the Sudbury Weed Education and Eradication Team, and their volunteers have done a lot of work on our properties. We do not have dedicated volunteers. We had tried to do that several years ago, and we didn't get a whole lot of interest from people. If anybody's interested, please contact me.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 13? I don't see any other hands, so we're going to move on to a vote. This was moving the words of the article as you see it in your warrant. All those in favor of Article 13, motion, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes unanimously. 14 was on the consent calendar and already voted, and so we're now on Article 15, which was on the consent calendar, was pulled, and Mr. O'Brien, selectman, will make the motion.
Moving the words of the article, Mr. Moderator.
Receive a second. It does. Mr. O'Brien?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Moderator. As reported in the warrant, the town of Sudbury is looking to create to quote Ms. Dineen, another revolving fund, to support a new regional initiative that has been put together called the Regional Housing Services Office. This is a collaborative effort between the towns of Bedford, Concord, Lexington, Lincoln, Sudbury, and Weston. They've all signed an interlocal agreement. Mark, can you give me that slide? Third slide. They've signed an interlocal agreement that establishes the Regional Housing Office, and each one of these towns, with the exception of Sudbury, because we're providing the services, all of the other member towns will be paying membership fees. Those fees will be collected by the town, and through the interlocal agreement, the way it was written, those funds that are collected will be put into the revolving fund to be used not only to fund this effort, but to keep the money that comes from those communities in a revolving fund and out of Sudbury's general fund. Keeps those communities a little happier to make sure that there's an easy separate set of books to account for their membership fees. The establishment of the regional, the RHSO, is the result of 2 years of effort that's been sponsored by the Metropolitan Planning Council through a series of three different grants. They see it as a unique and creative initiative in the form of regionalized services, and the RHSO will be solely funded through the membership fees by the participating towns, as I have mentioned, and all financial activity will take place in the revolving fund as requested through this town meeting article. The budget for the first year of the service includes an $88,000 budget, which will be income from the membership fees from the five towns, and the budget relative to expenses is $88,000 as well. The Regional Housing Office is an innovative approach to regionalized efforts with surrounding communities and allows Sudbury to leverage administrative expenses and expertise while helping surrounding municipalities preserve their affordable housing inventory. And it's important to know that the services that will be provided include oversight and monitoring services for the towns and builds on the expertise that Sudbury has developed through our community housing office. This collaboration is not, I repeat, not focused or chartered with developing or producing any new housing, but will perform the administrative services necessary for making sure that those residents and developers are in compliance and remain in compliance with the restrictions and regulations of their property. And this helps municipalities preserve and maintain their individual affordable housing stock within their respective communities. Thank you, Mr. Moderator. We urge your support for this article.
And I assume the selectmen support the article.
Yes, we do, unanimously, Mr. Moderator.
Tammy Dufault of the Finance Committee.
FinCom supports this article.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 15, signify by raising your card, please. Yes, sir, could you stand up?
Brian Semple, 15 Revere Road. So just a quick question on this. So looks to me as though the benefits for these employees are going to be covered by any income we get. Mike, so that's the first question.
That's correct, Mr. Semple.
Thank you. Okay, and then I'm not as familiar with this, but do we then incur any type of pension liabilities or retiree health care benefits that we'd also have to pay?
All of the benefits, that's calculated into all of the expenses, and it's fully loaded. So the answer to your first question is yes, we do incur, and secondly, it'll be covered through the fees that are charged to the communities collected by the revolving fund.
Great, thank you.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 15? I see no other hands. All those in favor of the motion as it appears in the warrant, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It passes overwhelmingly. There's only a few votes against it. Article 16, Susan Giuliano of the Sudbury School Committee for a motion, which is before you in the view graph. And generally speaking, the presentations have to be exactly as long as the motions.
I move to indefinitely postpone.
Does that receive a second? It does. Ms. Giuliano?
Yes. This article concerns the laws that that prohibit the schools from charging fees for certain students that we bus. We've worked on this article consulting with the state and with our state representative, but feel it needs further research to better understand the policy and legal implications. We also want to spend some time pursuing potential coordination with other districts, gathering further input from parents, and assessing how it would be implemented operationally within the district. And then we'll look towards bringing it back next year based on that information.
Thank you. Any Finance Committee?
Finance Committee supports the indefinite postponement.
Selectman?
Board of Selectmen support postponement.
Anybody wish to be heard on the motion to indefinitely postpone Article 16? Yes, ma'am. Okay. A little premature. Now you may raise your card if you are in favor of the motion to indefinitely postpone. Those opposed, it passes unanimously. We're now on to Article 17, which has been withdrawn, so we'll move on to Article 18, street acceptances. Bob Hardy, selectman, to make a motion.
Move to accept the layout of Brookside Farm Lane from Landham Road to a dead end, a distance of 500 feet plus or minus, as laid out by the Board of Selectmen in accordance with the description and plan on file in the town clerk's office. To authorize the acquisition by purchase, by gift, or by a taking by eminent domain in fee simple of the property shown on said plan, and to appropriate the sum of $300 to be raised by transfer of $300 from Article 12 street acceptances of the 2004 annual town meeting for expenses in connection therewith.
Does it receive a second? It does. Mr. Hardy, I assume that the only difference between what appeared in the warrant and what's in your motion is that one of the streets were dropped and we only have one street remaining.
That's correct. Trevor Way has been removed for consideration this year.
Okay. And would you care to make a presentation for the selectmen?
Sure. Trevor Way has been removed due to concerns identified by the Conservation Commission, but we do expect those issues to be resolved in time for the 2012 annual town meeting. Therefore, the Board of Selectmen is only requesting the Brookside Farm Lane be accepted as a public street this year. So there is a difference between this article and the article in your warrant. Brookside Farm Lane was created under the subdivision control law, has been constructed according to town standards, and has been approved for acceptance by the Planning Board. A public hearing was held by the Selectmen on April 12, 2011, where abutters were invited to attend, and no issues were identified. Approval of this article means that the town will now accept responsibility for the road, including plowing and maintenance. The Board of Selectmen supports this article and respectfully requests your support for Article 19.
Tammy Dufault, Finance Committee.
Excuse me, Article 18.
FinCom supports this article.
Okay. This is a two-thirds vote, by the way. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 18, street acceptance? I see no hands. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it is a unanimous vote. We're now on to Article 19, regulation of dogs. Bob Hardy for a motion.
Move in the words of the article.
Receive a second. It does. Mr. Hardy?
This is a housekeeping article. As noted in the warrant, in 2009, fees were changed for individual dog licenses, but kennel fees were not changed. As a result, currently owners of individual dogs are paying more per dog than the kennel owners. So this article will bring the kennel dog licenses up to the level of individual dogs. Further, it adds a new category of charges within the kennel fees. Instead of a broad category of 5 to 10 dogs at $50, this would change to category 5 to 6 dogs having one fee amount and the 7 to 10 dog category having a higher fee. The Board of Appeals grants permission for an individual or an organization to operate a kennel. When a kennel license is obtained, the number of dog tags they're given is equal to the maximum number of dogs they are allowed to keep at the facility. The additional fee category bases the amount of the fee in a more equitable manner. For example, a kennel that keeps a maximum of 5 dogs will no longer be charged the same fee as a facility that houses 10 dogs. Nonprofit organizations, as in the past, will pay no fees for licensing regardless of the number of dogs. The Board of Selectmen supports this article and respectfully requests your support for Article 19.
Bob Jacobson, Finance Committee.
Mr. Moderator, I'll be playing the role of Bob Jacobson this evening. and the FinCom supports this article.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 19? I see no hands. All those in favor of Article 19, as in the words of the warrant, signify raising cards. Those opposed? It is yet another unanimous vote. We're on to Article 20. I am recusing myself as moderator for Article 20, as my law firm represents a party whose interests may be affected. They are affected by this proposal. I wish to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest or perceived partiality. Therefore, I have asked Assistant Moderator Kirsten Rupinian at this town meeting to preside and moderate over this Article 20. All those in favor of Kirsten being the moderator for this article and getting rid of me, signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, that is a unanimous vote.
Got a very busy schedule tonight. Okay, we are moving on to Article 20, the sewer system design and permitting. John Drabinski, chairman of the board, to make the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
You're welcome.
Move that the town appropriate sum of $1 million for the engineering, design, and permitting of the proposed Route 20 sewer system, including borrowing costs and expenses, and to raise this appropriation to treasurer with approval of the selectmen is authorized to borrow $1 million under General Laws, Chapter 44, Section 7, all appropriation hereunder to be contingent upon the approval of Proposition 2.5 debt exclusion in accordance with Mass General Laws, Chapter 59, Section 21C.
Thank you. Does that receive a second? Receive a second. Mr. Drabinski for a presentation.
Madam Chairwoman, Lisa Eggleston of the Technical Advisory Committee will make the presentation.
Lisa?
Good evening. The Sewer Assessment Technical Advisory Committee, or TAC, was appointed by the selectmen in 1999 and charged with investigating the potential for installation of a sewer system on Route 20. Comprised of representatives of various town departments with technical expertise in engineering, hydrogeology, and water systems, we have conducted this effort with the help of our Community Development Director, Jody Cadillac, and the town's consultants, Weston and Sampson Engineers, several of whom are here tonight in the back and available to help us answer questions. As the TAC chair, I am here to give you an update on the status of our work and to request your consideration for funding the next phase of the project, the design and permitting of the system. Before I go into any more detail on that, though, let me briefly summarize how we got to this point. Sudbury has been discussing wastewater treatment and disposal options for the Route 20 business corridor for over 40 years. Whereas on-site septic systems generally work for the residential areas of town, it has long been clear that it is not a sustainable strategy for our commercial sector, both environmentally and economically. This is due to a combination of factors, not the least of which is that the Route 20 area is plagued with low permeability soils and a high groundwater table, resulting in limited capacity for disposal, frequent system failures, and costly upgrades. The proximity of several of Sudbury's major water supply wells to the Route 20 commercial area also poses concern over possible contamination of the town's water supply, as much of the area sits above the Raymond Road drink aquifer. The well field just south of Route 20 supplies nearly 70% of the town's water. Recent revisions to Title V septic requirements, as well as increasingly more stringent regulations governing the protection of groundwater supplies, have compounded the already difficult task of wastewater disposal in the Route 20 area. Finding an alternative to on-site septic systems for Route 20 was one of the primary objectives identified in Sudbury's 1999 master plan as a means of protecting long-term protection of our water supply and the creation of a sustainable economic development strategy to relieve our reliance on residential property taxes. In 1999, the town voted to fund a needs assessment for the Route 20 business district, the first step in the state's comprehensive wastewater management planning process. Using a matrix analysis, every commercial property along Route 20 and the Union Ave Station Road area was evaluated to assess the adequacy of existing wastewater disposal systems to meet existing and projected demand. The conclusion of the analysis was that significant need for an alternative to on-site septic systems did exist, particularly in the central portion of the area, where 27 properties were deemed critical, either in categorical failure or in imminent danger of being so, and another 29 properties were deemed priority in terms of wastewater needs, on the basis of flow that is more than two-thirds of the systems evaluated. It was further concluded that in order to meet these needs, it would be best accomplished through a decentralized treatment system, i.e. sewering this area with localized treatment and groundwater discharge at a location to be determined. The findings of the need assessment were presented in several public forums during 2000 and 2001 and reviewed with representatives of DEP. With the allocation of $90,000 at the 2001 annual town meeting, this amount supplementing $61,000 donated by the business community and the Sudbury Foundation, the town voted to advance the project to the next step in the process, the evaluation and identification of a disposal location and preparation of a project environmental project evaluation report, or PER, for submittal to the state permitting agencies. Since that time, the TAC has focused on locating a site that could accept the needed volume of treated wastewater while maintaining watershed health and minimizing ecological impacts. The site screening process began by looking at parcels in the immediate Route 20 vicinity, but as these efforts proved unsuccessful, the search was systematically expanded, eventually including all large parcels within roughly 3 miles of Route 20. The DPW property and Haskell Field were among those tested, but rejected due to soil conditions or insufficient infiltration capacity, as were several privately owned parcels. Many, many more were screened out before even getting to the testing phase. The option of a potential shared disposal system with Raytheon Corporation was also investigated and eliminated. And at some point in the process, we did look at the possibility of discharging the wastewater through Framingham to the MWRA system or to pumping it west to the Marlboro Easterly Wastewater Treatment Plant. Both of these options have significant drawbacks. Ultimately, subsurface borings conducted at the Curtis Middle School in August of 2009 indicated soil conditions well suited for the development of a large-scale subsurface disposal system beneath the playing fields in front of the school. Subsequent load-scale testing conducted by Weston and Sampson engineers this past winter under DEP oversight confirmed the suitability of the site to accommodate even more than the needed capacity. Having finally cleared the hurdle of identifying a viable site for wastewater disposal, preparation of the PER is now underway and expected to be completed this spring. As part of this process, this conceptual layout of the proposed wastewater system was developed. The assumed service area would extend from Massasoit Ave to Lafayette Road on Route 20 and include Station Road and Union Ave up to Codger Lane. Currently, the properties in the proposed sewer area discharge approximately 187,000 gallons per day of wastewater. Our consultants have determined that an initial design flow of 270,000 gallons per day could be accommodated. The system would include a combination of gravity and pressure sewers laid under the roads within the service area, pump stations to move the effluent properly, and a treatment facility located at the town-owned Bushy property at 641 Boston Post Road. The treated wastewater would then be pumped up Horse Pond Road, 1.6 miles, to the groundwater recharge system at Curtis. The proposed treatment plant location is a 1.6-acre parcel that the town acquired in conjunction with the purchase of the Tippling Rock conservation land several years ago. Except for a small parking lot for the trailhead, it is currently vacant. It is also relatively isolated from developed residential areas and centrally located within the proposed service area, making it particularly well-suited for this purpose. The treatment processes and associated equipment would be fully enclosed within a building designed to blend into the neighborhood. The facility would include an odor control system, so no odors are anticipated to be noticeable outside the building. The facility would accommodate the existing trailhead parking and not interfere with the use of the property for conservation access. This is a streetscape view of what the property might look like. As far as the groundwater recharge system at Curtis, it would be very similar to the septic leach fields we all have in our own backyards or front yards, or that Curtis currently has in below the adjacent field, except that this one would be bigger, and rather than discharging untreated septage, the effluent would be highly treated and disinfected. The field would need to be disturbed during system installation, but then would be fully restored to a playable condition. So now we get to the question on everyone's mind. How much is this going to cost, and what benefits will we see as taxpayers? Going forward, the project is broken down into two distinct phases, the design and permitting phase and the construction phase. The first is the subject of this article. It would entail detailed design of the collection, treatment, and disposal systems, as well as obtaining a DEP groundwater discharge permit and environmental review through the Mass Environmental Policy Act, or MEPA, process. This phase would take approximately 18 months to complete and would cost about $1 million. As proposed, the cost of this phase would be apportioned between all taxpayers in Sudbury, residential and commercial, and it would be borrowed over a 5-year period, resulting in a total cost of $175 to the average residential taxpayer with a home assessed at $628,000 and $300 to the average commercial taxpayer with a business assessed at $810,000. So for the average residential property owner, your tax impact would be approximately $35 each year for 5 years, and then it would drop back down to the original level. With Sudbury's current split tax rate,
Lisa, how much?
I have, sorry, one more page.
Is that okay with the hall? Do we have approval? Very good.
Okay. With Sudbury's current split tax rate, a larger proportion of this article is being paid for by the commercial taxpayers. However, the entire burden is not being placed on the commercial sector, as all Sudbury residents will benefit once a sewer is installed and the groundwater supply is protected. Also, not all of the commercial property owners in Sudbury would be served by the proposed sewer, yet they all pay taxes. The first phase is viewed as an investment in Sudbury's future, as the planned improvements will also create the opportunity for Sudbury's commercial sector to generate more revenue, thereby decreasing the residential tax burden. We anticipate the design and permitting phase to be completed in early 2013 and would expect to come back to the annual town meeting for construction funding either at the 2013 or 2014 annual town meeting. Construction of the system is currently estimated to cost approximately $14 million. However, we will have a much better handle on this cost once we get into and through the design process. Construction is expected to be about 2 years. A final decision on how to allocate the construction costs or how they will be apportioned between taxpayers has not been determined, but it is anticipated that the majority of the costs would be recovered through the assessment of betterment fees on the properties to be served. These properties would be improved or bettered by the construction of the sewer. A betterment is a one-time tax that can be paid either in a lump sum or it can be funded over a 20-year period by the town. Financed, I'm sorry. The amount of the betterment is typically calculated based on proportional flows. The town could use a combination of taxes and fees to pay for the project, since the vitality of the commercial district and the tax revenue it brings is a general benefit to all residents. This will need to be decided after significant public discussion. We are confident that an equitable arrangement can be approved which does not overburden any one property owner or sector. ongoing operational costs of the treatment facilities would be paid completely by the users of the system. Prior to funding the construction phase, there will be ample time for the legal and political aspects of the project to be thoroughly studied, discussed, and brought before the voters. These include identifying the organizational authority for the sewer district, determining when properties in the service area would need to tie into the system, establishing fee structures, and implementing any zoning changes needed to control growth. In the 10 years that it has taken us to identify a feasible disposal site and come up with a conceptual plan, the need for sewers in this area has only increased. According to Board of Health records, at least 10 commercial sewer septic systems in the proposed service area failed within just the last 3 years. All entailed significant costs to replace the systems with no ability to expand. Other properties are just getting by, pumping their systems on a monthly basis, and still others will need to be replaced in the near future. This hurts the bottom line of businesses and reduces property values. Property owners along the corridor are severely limited in their ability to attract new tenants, particularly food services, and existing tenants have no opportunity to expand. Restaurants like Bertucci's and Panera Bread, who've expressed interest in locating in Sudbury, have had to be turned away due to the lack of sewer, as have dentists, doctors, hair salons, bakeries, dog groomers, and the like. Several hair salons have recently had to move out of town. With Wayland and Marlboro both having sewers, Sudbury's commercial corridor is at a competitive disadvantage because of its wastewater treatment challenges. You have seen the letter to the editor, I hope, from the Sudbury Crossing and Sudbury Farms Plaza owners requesting your support of this project. Additionally, a joint letter from all of the plaza owners, Sudbury Crossing, Sudbury Farms, Rugged Bear, and Shaw's Plaza, as well as the Chamber of Commerce, was delivered to the selectmen last week, indicating broad support and a willingness to shoulder a significant portion of the construction costs. We have met with representatives at Raytheon, who are also supportive. The Finance Committee supports the article, as does the Planning Board, Conservation Commission, Sudbury Water District, and the Sudbury School Committee. Even with an affirmative vote tonight, we are still at least 3 to 4 years away from having a system in operation. Please let us not delay any further. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob Jacobson, reporting for the FinCom.
The Finance Committee unanimously supports Article 20. We believe that diversifying our tax base and securing revenue opportunities beyond the traditional residential property tax is critical to the long-term sustainability of Sudbury. In addition, this article builds upon the recommendation of the Budget Review Task Force.
Thank you. Mr. Drabinski from the Board of Selectmen.
Yes, the Board of Selectmen is a 2-0 vote. There's one abstention because one of our board members is a butter to the project and he wanted to abstain. Now, I want to add what Mr. Rao said, that the main goal here is one, paramount is to protect our fragile water supply, which is to the south of Route 20. Two, to sustain the business district and make sure that the businesses stay in town. And finally, to provide for tax relief. But once the businesses start moving out of town, the tax is going to shift on the residential side. So I think it's important that we maintain and sustain a viable and vibrant business district. Thank you.
Thank you. Planning Board? Mr. Polk?
Thank you. The Planning Board is enthusiastically in support of this article. We've been working diligently with the selectmen over the past decade to find solutions on the wastewater problems in the business district. This most recent effort of the sewering for Route 20 began in 1999 when the Planning Board was writing the master plan. It had been 37 years since the previous plan was written and was long overdue. The master plan introduced the concept of sustainability, where issues were interconnected to provide long-term solutions without burdening future generations. During the drafting of the master plan, through public forums and surveys, residents expressed their ideas on what they wanted Sudbury to be and what they did not want it to be. They wanted less reliance on residential property taxes, more revenue from the commercial sector. They proposed getting there by creating a more dense pedestrian village atmosphere where you could walk from stores and services. They wanted residential housing interspersed with the businesses, and they also wanted to ensure protection of the town's natural resources over the long term. These desires became the goals of the master plan. The objectives and strategies for how these are accomplished led us in the direction of moving forward to a Route 20 sewer system so that all those matters could be addressed. And while we have touched on addressing economic development, streetscape improvements, vacancies, and zoning along Route 20, we cannot create much more than what we have there now without a sewer. So that is what we have focused on over the past several years. The vacancy signs can indicate some of the struggles that we've seen in the economic district over recent times. Lisa addressed the needs of the assessment and the identification of critical needs that many of our businesses have, but this is not just for show. Without alternative wastewater disposal methods, the economic viability of some of our businesses, as well as the quality of our groundwater, is at risk. We are now at a turning point where we either commit to constructing a sewer system or we don't. We can move forward with progressive planning and infrastructure development, or be faced with commercial vacancies, a failing business district, and further deterioration of the Route 20 streetscape. Over the last month or so, I've been heavily engaged in conversations with many of my neighbors and fellow residences about this project. There have been some criticisms that we should not proceed to the design until residents know what the zoning will be or what other development implications there may be. Yet while the desire to revise zoning along Route 20 has always been a part of the project, it is not a paramount issue. Protection of the town's drinking water is critical, and for that reason alone, we should proceed without haste on the design. I'm not going to stand here and pretend to ignore the elephant in the room, however, so let's talk about zoning. Our current zoning is very protective of Sudbury's character and is well suited for the current conditions that we have and the design of the sewer system. We have strong zoning which supports the existing businesses and protects Sudbury against undesirable land uses, and have made some important changes, but small changes, to zoning over the years to help reinforce the master plan goals. Some highlights on the zoning in our business districts: we prohibit fast food drive-throughs, we require parking behind buildings and construction of buildings closer to the road, we have additional review processes for any commercial structure greater than 20,000 square feet, and we have superior landscaping standards. There is no immediate threat that would require us to make hasty or any changes at this time. Additionally, installing sewers will not dramatically increase the developability of property. That would only come throughout zoning changes, which require public meetings and a town meeting vote and a Route 20 master plan. We anticipate that concurrently with review of zoning over the next 18 months while the sewer system is being designed. Soon after town meeting concludes, the selectmen will initiate a public process furthering this partnership, involving residences and businesses, to begin planning for the future of Route 20 with decentralized wastewater treatment. A citizens advisory committee will be formed and will include subcommittees on creating a vision for Route 20, writing zoning bylaws, defining the wastewater service area, preparing bylaws and regulations for the wastewater treatment facility, including its operation and administration, planning for other Route 20 streetscape improvements like submerging utilities, and other execution of construction and other issues. The CAC will be a catalyst for zoning changes directed by the residents and businesses, and will be the primary opportunity for residents to take a part in the shaping of Route 20. The planning board will be acutely involved in this process. There are many good examples in Massachusetts of successful mixed-use business districts and corridors, and studying these examples will be an important aspect of this effort. Preserving the character of Sudbury and creating development opportunities without allowing overdevelopment is of the utmost concern. Therefore, adopting proper zoning controls needs to be carefully studied and executed. Even with no zoning changes at all, the proposed wastewater system is planned for design and construction to handle approximately a 40% increase in flow from the existing properties in the service area. This would allow additional restaurants to locate in the existing shopping plazas, accommodate the renovation of vacant second floor office space into residential units, and allow for the expansion of existing properties where all other zoning bylaws currently are complied with. So in the near future, we could see some redevelopment and change of use in the existing businesses. For the long-term vision of what we want and will need to address in the zoning regulations, it's an important and exciting part of the sewering project, and our vision for Route 20 will become its future. We do have some older examples of Route 20 redevelopment scenarios produced after the Route 20 visioning sessions that were conducted in 2001. The premise then, and it still may be favorable now, was to move buildings closer to the street so that pedestrians could access them more easily. With a sewer system, the construction of these street-side buildings may be accomplished in larger plazas without a need to tear down the existing buildings. Parking and stormwater would need to be addressed, however, but shared situations like this are becoming much more popular. Redevelopment would open up tremendous opportunity for shared vehicle access and residential options as well. The following slide shows redevelopment for new development options at Shaw's, Sudbury Crossing, and Sudbury Farms. What you can tell from these images is that the scale and character of Sudbury remains. The goal here is not to reshape Route 20 into Route 9 like Framingham or Route 20 in Marlborough. It is to create a more dense central business area with the existing commercially zoned areas, more of a Sudbury Main Street, a place to go for services, a bite to eat, and convenient shopping or leisure. Reducing corridor sprawl goes hand in hand with this vision as well, where outlying areas may be rezoned for less intense development and incentives are given to relocate businesses into the central core. We think these goals are quite attainable. Let me also discuss how the zoning process happens. This is where the residents really have an opportunity to voice opinion for the future of Route 20. We envision a year-long process where options are presented, discussed, revised, and advanced based on public meetings, design charrettes, surveys, similar to how the town-wide master plan was developed. Then, once a zoning scheme is chosen, it would be advanced to town meeting where a two-thirds vote is required. The planning board will direct this process, and we would likely be ready for town meeting in 2013. This analysis will take into account traffic impacts, fiscal impacts, new construction, wetland, and stormwater impacts. I want to end my presentation by going back to the need for sewers in the first place. This is about planning. This is about planning for the future of our water supply, the future of our economy, the future of our community, and providing for basic infrastructure so that our future is sustainable. The need has been demonstrated. The benefits impact all residents and businesses. The time is now. The Planning Board urges your support on Article 20 and the ballot question on the special election on June 7th. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. Mr. Cosart for the Water District.
Thank you, Madam Moderator. I'm Bill Cosart, 419 Concord Road. I'm the Chairman of the Board of Water Commissioners of Sudbury Water District. And the Sudbury Water District supports this article. In 1997, a discharge from the former Sunrise Cleaners in the Star Market Plaza resulted in trace quantities of trichloroethylene being detected in the aquifer that runs under our commercial district. 70% of our water comes from that physically unprotected aquifer. We corrected that problem through the installation of a stripper column at the wellhead. And the quality of our water is monitored under a rigorous schedule as promulgated by the DEP, and there are no issues at this time. Although this is no longer a problem, the experience from this spill shows that this aquifer is vulnerable to contamination. The vulnerability is further demonstrated by a trend towards a slightly increasing level of nitrate. In 2002, the DEP issued a source water assessment report wherein the susceptibility to contamination of the wells drawing from this aquifer is rated as high. What if this aquifer did become contaminated? There are three options. There's always the possibility of further treatment. Secondly, we could join the MWRA. And thirdly, we could look for additional sources, additional wells throughout town. Taking them one at a time, the treatment issue, most likely we could install treatment to address any issue. The issue, of course, becomes exactly what is the contaminant, and depending upon the contaminant, that would determine the cost to correct such a problem and the length of time involved in getting a solution approved. The second option, the sourcing with the MWRA, if we were in an emergency water situation, we could purchase water from MWRA on a short-term basis. That would be in effect while we design and get approval for a treatment. The approximate cost to the water district, if we were to go that way, is about $20,000 or $25,000 a day to purchase water that would supplement the loss of what we've incurred there. If we really had a major problem here and we had to go to a permanent connection to MWRA, there's an entrance fee that when you join the MWRA, in our case, it would probably be something in excess of $2.5 million just to join the MWRA. And then, of course, we'd be subject to the substantially higher water rates as charged by MWRA. The third option, new water wells. I'm sorry to inform you that we've exhausted all potential sites for additional wells. There is only one site that was successful, and the water district is proceeding to secure title to that property. There's an abundant supply of water at that site, but treatment would be necessary before we could use it, and there would be a substantial length of hookup to get from that site into our current lines. So the Sudbury Water District urges you to support this article to protect our water supply. Thank you.
Okay. Before we start taking questions, I just want to let the hall know that we have some professionals from Weston and Sampson in the hall. They are not residents, but if we have the leave of the hall to allow them to answer technical questions specifically, I will bring them forward. Do we have the leave of the hall? Please raise your cards. Very good. If the Weston and Sampson people want to come forward, that's fine. And we can start taking questions. Does anybody wish to be heard on this motion? Sir?
Thank you, Madam Moderator. My name is Sam Webb, 21 Windmill Drive here in Sudbury, and I'm one of the Conservation Commissioners here in town. And we have discussed this in depth at the Conservation Commission meetings, and you've heard a lot already about the marginal soils that we have and the groundwater issues we have, and obviously protecting our potable water is of utmost importance. The Conservation Commission also, over the past 7 years, has experienced the 13 different wastewater repairs and failed systems in the downtown area with restaurants and everything else from Friendly's to Lotus Blossom and Mill Village. So this is a huge problem, and we are very much in support of going forward with this to sustain Sudbury's ability to increase revenue and protect our potable water. Obviously, we know this is the first step to ensure long-term viability for our water, but we believe this economic development would better balance our tax income and that we cannot begin to solve the burden on the residential taxpayers without looking for growth and viability in our business and commercial sector. So a decentralized wastewater system can provide long-term tax relief and water quality protection. Treatment of our water supply will be much more costly over the long term if our wells are impaired due to marginal or failed septic systems. And this was unanimously supported by the Conservation Commission. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard? Over here.
Bill Cooper, Cedar Creek Road. The presenter of the motion dwelt at some length on the disposal of the liquid effluent from the treatment plant, but didn't speak at all to the disposal of the solids that are likely to be generated. I'd like to know what the preliminary plans are on how those solids might be disposed of.
Lisa?
If I may, I'm going to defer to our technical consultant.
Very good. Thank you.
Good evening. Right now, it's a little preliminary to say exactly the route we'd go with those solids. The size of the plant that we're proposing here is a plant which we would not typically do any type of solids processing on site. We would typically liquid dispose of all the solids from here. So what will happen is we'll actually accumulate sludge, and over a period of time it will be trucked out in liquid form. When I say liquid form, it's it'll be decanted to some degree to limit the volume of those trucks that would leave, but it would be brought out in essentially a tank truck. The two most common methods that are used for that disposal when we get rid of liquid right now are, one, to be further processed and pressed, dewatered by a press, and composted on an off-site facility. Or the other option is to be incinerated, which is still pretty common for a lot of these facilities right now. Those two options occur at a site to be determined based on a contracting method that we would use once we put the plant in place. Notable places where those happen right now is most common ones are Woonsocket, Rhode Island, Fitchburg, Mass., a couple other places like that.
Follow-up question, please. Is the now closed septic plant on Route 20 suitable for disposal of these solids?
I believe you answered the question. It is now closed.
Could be reopened.
Any questions down here? Frank?
Frank Lyons, 157 Wayside Inn Road. I recently went to a public meeting where they were talking about an upgrade to the Easterly Wastewater Treatment Plant, and there were a number of residents from Marlboro who lived around the wastewater treatment plant. Their biggest concern was odor. Can you tell us anything about potential odor problems with this treatment plant?
As I indicated before, we will have a state-of-the-art odor control system for the building, and that would be where any odors would be generated, would be inside the building. So the treatment, the odor control system should absolutely take care of that, and we don't expect any odors to be detectable outside of the building. And the effluent is disinfected, so that pretty much eliminates the odors there.
Right here, sir.
Bruce Lamier, 9 Bentbrook Road. Was gray water considered in this part of the system? And if not, why not?
I assume that what you're talking about in terms of gray water is reuse of some of the water, or gray water reuse. It's something that could be incorporated into this design. We just haven't gotten to that point yet. And we're not sure that the opportunity really exists there without replumbing buildings and so forth. It certainly has not been eliminated.
Okay. Right here, Mr. Coe.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. I was a member of the Oversight Committee of the septage facility, and I believe I can answer Dr. Cooper's question. We did not have the ability to process solids on site. We trucked them away in the same way that's being proposed for this facility. So I don't think that even if the plant were reopened for that purpose, it would require a considerably different approach to the way the plant was operated than anything that's been done heretofore.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions over here, right here? In the back? Rick?
Thank you, Madam Moderator. Rick Johnson, 38 Bent Road. Can we use CPA funds for any of this?
Can you repeat that?
Can we use CPA funds for any of this?
Hold on, I'll have to ask the...
The answer is no. If you need further explanation, I will defer to the chair of the CPA.
Sure.
Then on the spot, I'm going to have to remember all the...
Chris, can you stand up so people can see who's talking? Thanks.
The CPA is on? There we go. The CPA is for the creation or preservation of four different areas, none of which are wastewater treatment.
But we're trying to preserve our drinking water supply?
Doesn't work.
Doesn't work?
Sorry.
Okay. Next question.
Richard, can you stand up so we can see you too? Thank you.
Both residential properties and commercial properties in the service area would be accommodated to tie into the sewer system. I'd feel a lot more comfortable if it said would be required. The businesses are looking for help from us, and will there be language in there that will require the businesses to tie in?
Planning board?
Every property within the sewer district will receive the betterment, so they will be charged for the opportunity to tie into the sewer. One of the things that we do have to work out is who is going to be required, and if so, when they will be. Part of it is a timing issue. There are, although the vast majority of the systems are limping along or in failure, there are still some systems there that are operating, and the owners of those properties are not necessarily dying to spend a lot of money tying into the sewer system. So this is part of what is going to have to be figured out over the course of the design and figuring out the structuring of the fees and the funding will also be at when the various flows are going to come along.
And I guess that there's nothing here that tells us how we're going to pay for this. It just says it'll be a mix between the property taxes and the businesses. Can the FinCom or the Selectmen, can you offer us any help here on how we're going to pay for this? Is it all going to be on the residents, or there is going to be some sort of betterment, but they're not saying how much of a betterment and how much is going to go to the residents?
Can I?
Yes.
Thank you. I will start to answer that question, and then if FinCom or the Selectmen want to join in, they are certainly welcome to do so. First of all, that has not yet been determined, and it's something that will be the subject of more discussion, and that will need to come back to town meeting before it is finalized. But at this point, the assumption is that the vast majority of the cost will be borne by the business community or the service area in the form of betterments. There are other forms of fees that basically when they upgrade their properties to increase wastewater discharge, there can be a fee charge there, as well as taxes. The balance has not been determined, but the anticipation is that the majority would be paid by those properties, and I believe that the letter I showed earlier of support, you know, the business community has stated they understand that and are willing to take that on. Several of the comments that I heard as we met with the business owners over this project were that the costs that they anticipate for this, they already have budgeted just for septic system replacement upgrades and so forth, just to get along with what they have now. No increase in capacity.
Okay.
And one last question. I'm sorry. Just my last one. It's estimated $14 million today, and I hate to see it to get to big dig numbers from $2 billion to $22 billion. So can you help us, Weston and Sampson? Where'd you get this number from, and how can that number grow in the next 3 years? Because if we're going to approve $1 million tonight, if it grows to $30 million and nobody wants to spend $30 million, we just wasted $1 million. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very good question. The costs of wastewater facilities are, as you mentioned, some pretty notable ones in the news usually come up. They tend to vary quite a bit depending upon what you're building. But the thing that is pretty consistent is the size of the system determines really the cost that you're talking about. And there's a lot of this type of construction that goes on across the state and in the region year to year, not in Sudbury but in other communities and right in your vicinity. We have access to a database of costs that actually we use to refer to when we do planning level costs. And again, the $14 million is a planning level cost at this point, But it is intended to be pretty conservative for a number of reasons. One is we know that the treatment plant that we need to build, it's small, but we want it to do a couple of things. One, we want it to create a very high-quality effluent. So we've actually designed the cost to support a membrane treatment process, which is a very high level of treatment. It will give us a very pure effluent. The second thing is we know that we want to have a building around all the tankage. Somebody mentioned some of the other plants that have some odor issues. One of the main concerns here is to make sure that we mitigate any impacts on the neighborhood, particularly visual, and contain any odors that would be there. So we're going to put a building over everything or enclose all the tankage. Those have some extra costs. So right now we've actually already put together an estimate that includes some of those things. We have seen plants of this size and collection systems of a similar size to yours built for less money. The budget is set, I think, based on some pretty good judgment of what those are. It's not a Cadillac system budget. Certainly, it's intended to be a budget that's affordable, but it is a budget that's based on some good basic information that's available on the size of these systems. And I think that's the way to set this budget at this point and the most advisable thing, and that's where we got to.
Thank you. I have a question down here, ma'am. In the front.
Me?
Yeah, you can. Well, we'll go there, and then we'll go in the back.
Jeffrey Clough, 15 Iron Works Road. Two things. First, a comment on the odor issue. I was involved in a neighborhood association that was when I lived in Marlboro. The odor problem in Marlboro was caused by composting of the solid waste in an unclosed facility. So I think this is a very different thing that we're talking about. So I don't think that we would worry necessarily about the odor. My thing is more of a question slash comment. Well, through zoning, I think we can kind of protect how much density is there. But my question is, will the system and the design take into account the potential for a 40B development that could end up in this area, kind of changing the density calculation? So will that be considered in the design, I guess?
I don't believe that we can address 40B in zoning because it specifically is outside of zoning. But we have looked at the issue of whether or not this could lead to more 40Bs. And, Jody, do you think it's – should we put that –
Well, either way, I guess that's really not what my question is, because the 40Bs are going to go there or not go there, whether the sewer's there. But my question is more, if one does go there, that potentially could increase the capacity or the need for capacity to the system. So I would hate to see the system design and then a project go in there and all of a sudden now we're in a situation where the system can't handle the capacity. So I guess my question is more, are we anticipating that potentially in our design so that if that does happen, we don't end up with a capacity issue?
Our current design capacity does have sufficient excess capacity in there for full build-out of the area, including some change in use.
Okay, thanks.
Back there. She had her hand raised. I'm going to get to everybody. Just have to make it.
I'm Rebecca Chisholm. I live on Whitetail Lane. Nobody's mentioned anything about traffic, and you know, 2 years along Boston Post Road could really be interesting. So I was wondering if you had considered what you would do and also if there will be any costs associated with traffic, detouring, police, and other things that might come up because of all the digging.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Are you prepared to answer that, Lisa?
Sorry, I was just consulting with our consultants. The two-year construction period is for all of the various systems, the collection, treatment, and disposal systems. Probably the disruption to Route 20 would be more like 6 months. Most of the activity would be taking place on the Bushy property and also at the disposal location. The traffic impacts would be temporary.
Thank you. Anybody? Over here, Beck. Sir, yes.
Douglas Grant, 375 Old Lancaster Road. This is the first time I've even heard that.
Can you speak a little louder into the microphone?
I'm sorry. This is the first time that I've heard that this project is going to be planned for the Curtis Middle School area. And I'm just wondering, as a neighbor, it's basically just a residential neighborhood, and are you anticipating some legal battles with this? Because in terms of costs, I mean, I know that it just seems like when you put one of these facilities in and you're a neighbor abutting this type of property, that there's a lawsuit coming down the road. And is this going to be impacting in terms of the overall cost and timetable? I mean, so you're going to approve $1 million, but then somebody says, forget, I don't want this thing sitting behind me. Are we going to, is it going to be tied up in litigation, basically? Are you anticipating that at this point?
Thank you. Lisa?
I believe the question was having to do with the disposal field at Curtis in terms of whether we are anticipating any litigation from the neighbors. We certainly are not anticipating that. We have tried to be very open about this process. Hopefully it's not a surprise to anybody that we have been discussing this. We did sit down with the school committee early on when we started to focus on Curtis. We obviously had to get their permission to do the testing. And got their support. We would certainly be happy to have those conversations with the neighbors. We fully expect to involve them in the process as we do the environmental review. One thing I would like to emphasize, though, is that we are talking about a very polished treated effluent that is getting discharged below grade in the fields. Right now, there is a septic system at Curtis that would remain undisturbed, but the quality of what's going into the ground there now is nowhere near as high as what we would be proposing to discharge. So our anticipation is that there would not be an impact to the neighborhood and certainly no cause for litigation. So, no, we have not factored that in.
Okay. Question? Right down front, Sue.
The Sudbury School Committee unanimously supports this article. We view this as one of the as a component in the town's long-term plans to move towards sustainability and enhance revenue, and also recognize the importance for the protection of drinking water. We'll continue to work closely with the town to address any issues of concern or any issues of implementation regarding the fields at Curtis.
Thank you. Back. Pat.
Pat Brown, 34 Whispering Pine Road. When the Technical Advisory Committee, of which Lisa is the chair, was formed in 1999, there was a parallel committee, the Citizens Advisory Committee. And you would partly know that if you went out to the website for the Technical Advisory Committee and see that there is a Citizens Advisory Committee associated with it. You would never be able to find the Citizens Advisory Committee website because there isn't one. The Citizens Advisory Committee, as near as I can tell, sort of percolated along without ever establishing any presence, actually, until 2008, when the Board of Selectmen indefinitely disbanded it. And so in 2008, the Citizens Advisory Committee went away. The purpose of the Citizens Advisory Committee, unlike the engineering people who are looking at how do you get water through the soil, the purpose of the Citizens Advisory Committee was to deal with issues of funding, of politics, of citizen involvement, of all the things that are not, have not happened, of all the things that will happen, theoretically, as soon as we hand over $1 million. And I have a problem with the order here. I have a problem with the part where there's, I mean, the technical advisory people put out an FAQ last week on their website. I don't know how many here have read it, because I don't know how many here know that it was there. But even if you have read it, you're not answering my questions, you're answering your questions. We as citizens have just not had any kind of input into this, and in particular, the elephant in the room, the zoning. We don't know what this is looking like. We're going to go ahead and do the design, and then we're going to get citizen input on the vision. I just have real problems with the process. I'd like to ask specifically the Board of Selectmen why the Citizens Advisory Committee was disbanded in 2008.
Mr. Drabinski?
Yes. The reason the Citizens Advisory Committee was disbanded was at that time that we did not have any effective location for disposal of the treated effluent. In the ensuing years, as Lisa pointed out, the Technical Advisory Committee with the consultants, we found an appropriate place to discharge the treated effluent. Now that we have that, the public process can go forward to look at zoning changes, look at the financial impact, figure out how to design and finance the system. Now we have a goal in mind. Now we can put the citizens to work to figure out how we implement this. So that's the reason. We didn't have an end point. Now we have an end point, and now we have a process to go forward.
But my understanding was that in the Sudbury 2000 Master Plan, we've been looking at sewering Route 20 for 40 years. So we certainly had an idea that that's what we wanted to do. And the Technical Advisory Committee, you know, with the help of the consultants, has been pushing that forward. And so it seems like now we're going to ask for citizen input after we've done the vote. Okay? And I personally have some real problems finding stuff out on the floor of town meeting 10 minutes before somebody asks me to raise the card. I'd really have liked some time to think about this. And I really think that postponing this until you have your technical issues nailed down it just makes it really, really hard for citizens. And I'm really sorry that's the way it was done. Thank you.
Lisa?
Yes, I am a technical person. But actually, the part of the reason that the Citizens Advisory Committee and the planning in terms of how to structure this and answer a lot of these questions, that work had to be suspended, was because until we had a disposal site, we did not know the volume of wastewater that we could adequately treat, or more importantly, dispose of. This was the guidance that was given to us by DEP when we met with them initially, was to focus on finding a disposal site because everything is dictated by that, and until you know the volume that you can safely treat and dispose of, you don't know your service area, what area can be served, and some of these issues in terms of where we have to go to pump to it. So a lot of these issues could not be addressed until now, and it is, as was stated earlier, fully our intent to proceed with answering those questions in parallel to the process of moving forward with design. But we are talking another 3 to 4 years before we can actually have a system in place, and I think our goal is to not waste any more time in this process.
Thank you. Over here, sir. Can you wait just a second for a mic? Thank you.
Fred Ballou, Lincoln Road, a very simple question, I hope. If this plan is implemented, how long will it last, the sewer system? Longer, I hope, than it takes to pay for it.
Yes.
That's another great question. Everything that you build has a lifetime. And in the particular case of what we're talking about, this essentially three different types of things that make up the system. One is buildings. The type of buildings that we build for wastewater systems tend, particularly for municipal systems, tend to be able to withstand some challenging environmental conditions and house equipment and be fairly industrial in its quality. We tend to see those buildings as having something on the order of 40 to 60 year life. Pretty typical. They will need renovation over that time. Everybody has a roof. Roofs need repair over time, and so within that lifespan, certainly every 20 years or so, we would be doing modifications to that. In addition, building systems, lights have to be changed, ventilation systems and heating systems have to be updated. But again, most of those have about a 20-year life. The thing that we get the most time out of is pipes. When we put things in the ground, they tend to be made out of concrete, steel, ductile iron in the case of some of the pipe, and plastic. Those pipes, based on the best information we have right now, many of those pipes that we put in a century ago that were made of wood and other types of cast iron are still in existence in this region of the country. So there's good evidence that shows they'll last a long time, but we usually, again, attach a life of maybe 50 to 60 years on the pipes, and we'd expect that we'll do some type of rehabilitation to those facilities over time. The shortest piece is what we like to call equipment. Process equipment, rotating equipment, things like pumps and motors and things, they tend to run all the time in a system like this. So what ends up happening is we tend to wear those through in a shorter period of time. And the life cycle of those would vary, depending upon what it is, from 10 to 20 years for certain pieces of equipment. With good maintenance, I'm working on a lot of plants right now that have pieces of equipment that have run every day for 40 years in constant duty under very severe conditions. But again, when we go to budget, we actually suggest that we plan into the cycle about every 20 years an upgrade of the facility. So I think the answer, the short answer to your question is somewhere between 20 and 60 years is likely, with some expenditures through those periods of time to keep maintenance up.
Thank you. Any questions?
Jan Hardenberg, 7 Tippling Rock Road. Are there any are there any possible technical reasons why we would procure the $1 million now but decide that we couldn't build the sewer later? And if so, how likely are they?
I think they're highly unlikely at this point because of the testing that we did this winter. That was the preliminary work on a groundwater discharge permit, and we did the hydrogeo testing. It was called load scale testing, where they basically dug a hole and poured water in there for several days and monitored it to make sure it went in and stayed in and so forth, and basically have done some preliminary determinations on that in terms of capacity. I don't think that we anticipate any surprises as far as that goes. The likelihood of getting denied is very low. I mean, we've been in conversation with DEP. And the discharge is the limiting factor, as I said. One other thing, if I may, on the previous question, I do want to make the point that the replacement cost of those pumps and equipment, the 20-year cycle that Kent was talking about, that would presumably be paid by the user fees. We're not talking about coming back to town meeting in 20 years.
Thank you. Questions over here, sir?
Kevin Long, 7 South Meadow Drive. I have two questions. The first question is, can you commit to a minimum percentage that the betterments would cover, or is this basically a blank check from the taxpayers?
Lisa? Anybody?
Anybody?
I think the selectman may have to.
I can get a question.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, can you commit to a minimum percentage that the betterments would cover?
I don't understand.
I mean, otherwise, it's basically a blank check from the taxpayers.
Know if we could commit to that right now. I think we need to understand what the betterment structure is going to look like. We need to understand what the flows will look like from the individual businesses. I think, as Lisa said, it's an ongoing process, but we will have those discussions with the business district. Right now, we're talking about a concept, but I think we have a good estimate from the engineers what the overall cost would be. We have a good idea what the preliminary design phase would be. So going forward, as Lisa said, this would be more on the business side, but the residents who will benefit also will have to put a little bit of skin in the game, and it's important that we all understand that this is, while it's helping directly the business community, at the end of the day, it's impacting the entire community. Mm-hmm. It's protecting our water supply. It's giving us a vibrant and sustainable business district, and if we don't do this, and it's up to the town meeting to decide here, we don't do this, we're jeopardizing the health of our business district. In 20 years hence, when we don't have a business district and we're wondering why our taxes on the residential side is so high, and we can't afford teachers, schools, and special ed costs, that we need to think about what we're doing here tonight. So we need to have a vision looking forward, and I think it's important to all of us really understand what we're doing tonight. We're really redefining the vision of Sudbury to make it a sustainable town so that we can keep residents and businesses here and make sure that our environment is protected. That's basically what we're talking about. It's going to cost all of us a little extra money. Hope the business side will pay more. The residents can pay a little bit more also. But at the end of the day, it's about this community being sustainable and that we can have places to shop, restaurants to eat, and providing, you know, recreation for our children and great education for our children also. So we're looking at an entire community here, and this is the vision we're trying to create. So please, let's not get bogged down in some of the details, because we got a lot to work on, but it's really important how we go forward. So it's, I'm not trying to preach, but it's just important how we understand this vision.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I understand the answer. You're saying that it could be $14 million on the taxpayers? And if that's the case...
I don't think that's what he was saying at all. I don't think so, no.
No, the cost is going to be $14 million. You want to talk about some of the funding costs, Lisa, SRF?
Yeah, hold on. Eric, I'm going to recognize Eric. Answer your question.
There's a very important consideration with this that actually goes back to one of the earlier questions about the CAC. This entire process is somewhat chicken and egg. You need to determine some things concretely before you can move to the next step to determine what those next list of items are. That's the spot we find ourselves in now. For the approximate 4 years that the CAC worked in the early 2000s, we looked at funding options, we looked at betterment cost allocations, we looked at fees, we looked at construction costs. They all got thrown out the window because we had no place to discharge the effluent, we had no place to treat the septage, there was nothing to go on. That process stopped. Now that the Technical Advisory Committee has come back with a suitable site, or suitable sites for both purposes, we find ourselves in another situation like this where we have certain design and construction processes which have to occur now. The testing that was done, the hydrogeological testing that was done toward the end of last year, unfortunately came back a little late in the timetable from where we would have liked it to be. Had it happened on our timetable, we would have had a little bit more opportunity to come before the public to educate people a little bit more in advance of town meeting. That didn't happen. Nonetheless, we're in a situation now where, should we not proceed, we run the risk of losing certain funding options, certain financing options, and certain windows that keep us on a timetable where we can actually have this in place by 2015. To try and specifically answer your question about betterments and what would the charges be to residents versus the businesses, our discussions with the businesses so far have suggested that their 10 to 15 year budgets currently for replacement, operations, and maintenance of septic includes nearly 100% of the construction costs estimated at $14 million. The financing for the $14 million that we would put before you in a couple of years at town meeting would likely be funded at 20 or 30 years, depending on the financing options. So while we can't commit to an absolute number today, it's very likely that a very significant portion of the construction fees would be borne by the businesses, not by the residents. All of this, however, will be vetted in public forums, has to come before town meeting, and any other cost allocation on the residents or the businesses has to be presented in that fashion. So unfortunately, we can't give you an absolute number right now, but all things look like the burden on the residential taxpayers will be very slight.
Okay, thank you. My second question, if someone could explain, I'm having a hard time understanding the alternatives. The MWRA cost was $2.5 million to tie in versus $14 million build a sewer system. I'm having a hard time understanding the analysis.
Okay, just Lisa, hold on. I think that the discussion about the MWRA was the $2 million just to join. It was just a joining fee. I think there's a lot more concurrent costs after that. Is that correct, Bill?
And that was going for water.
That was for water, not sewer. Yes, you made it.
Yes, just to clarify, the $2 million that was quoted was if we needed to get water because ours was contaminated. We did briefly investigate tying into the MWRA system with the wastewater. It would, in essence, mean piping it down to Framingham. There are MWRA sewers relatively close by. They have all sorts of problems there that we would have to help pay to help them out of. We would also be taking Sudbury's lovely groundwater, and shipping it out for treatment and disposal into Boston Harbor. It is known in the state as an out-of-basin transfer, and it is highly frowned upon if you have any in-town options for disposal, particularly because it is taking away recharge from our water supply. So it really is not a desirable option. It also is a very expensive option. Thank you, Lisa. If I may, I can just add one other thing on the previous question regarding the distribution of costs. Although we are currently anticipating that the betterments would be about 70% of the cost, we cannot commit to that because it is a town meeting vote, so we cannot make that commitment. We have run the numbers for even if this were funded, for instance, by 100% by the taxpayers, which we're not by any means asking for, but just to understand what we're talking about in terms of what we'd be taking on, at the $14 million cost funded over a 20-year period, it would be approximately $140 per household for the average household for that 20-year period. If we go to a 50% share, it would be half of that. And so on. Thank you, Lisa. Let me just see. How many more people have questions? Can you just raise your hand? Okay, I have one, two, Brian, and three. Okay, so let's just get these questions and four down here.
Adam Miller, Knobscot Road. I have a question as to how a sewer system like this would be administered as an entity after it's constructed. I guess we haven't come to a decision on that, I guess, but in similar installations around the state, how is it typically administered?
So you're asking who owns it?
Yeah.
Any answer?
You're absolutely right. That's one of the things that the Citizens Advisory Committee would be in charge of suggesting to town meeting and the selectmen. There are a number of options that these types of organizations can operate under. It can either be a municipal organization, it can be a sewer district, it can be something in between. That's one of the things that needs to be decided. And again, part and parcel with deciding what that administration structure looks like helps determine what some of your options are with regard to financing, raising tax levies, charging betterment fees, et cetera. So those discussions need to happen before you can just determine what's the best option.
Thank you. Carol, I think you have a question. And I'll get back over here in a second.
Thank you. I'd like to revisit...
Your name for the record?
Carol Wolf, 637 Concord Road. I'd like to revisit the 40B issue. Now, I've read various things. I've read that with a sewer, you could have 40 units in townhouses per acre, or 160 units in mid-rise units per acre. I've read you cannot limit how many there would be per acre. And I'm concerned because we talk about increasing revenue from businesses, but I was just wondering how 40Bs would be limited. Thank you.
Can somebody address this 40B situation? Jody
Kablak, Director of Planning and Community Development. I knew I'd get put into this discussion at some point. We've looked at the implications of high-density residential development, 40B, mixed use, overlay districts, a number of things just to kind of frame this question that we did anticipate coming up. We don't have the slide up in front of us, but if you looked at the service area,
The service area is a relatively small area. It's about 1.4 miles along Boston Post Road, predominantly zoned commercial. And we typically don't think that commercially zoned properties will revert to residential. It's just a lesser value property. So what we're really talking about are the residential properties that are in the service area along Boston Post Road. And if the slide were up, and I don't know if Mark could get that slide up quickly. It was in Lisa's presentation. Most of the residentially zoned properties are very small properties. They are not deep at all. They're about 150 to 300 feet deep. And they don't present a huge opportunity for large-scale residential development. We also have examples of 40Bs along Boston Post Road that have been approved and or constructed. One is on the western side of the service area, which is the Carriage Lane condominium right across from Bullfinch's. This is a fairly dense residential development. It's on about 2.5 acres. It's 16 units, and it is served by an on-site septic system. Okay. Which is right about in this location. I'm going to turn this one. So what you can see here are these very shallow parcels are the residential properties. Longfellow Glen is also a residentially zoned property, but is much larger and is already constructed as a 40B. The larger areas, these are all the commercial areas. So again, I'm just going to go back to, we have Carriage Lane here, which is a 40B, 16 units on 2.5 acres with a septic system. But we have the other spectrum as well. We have an approved 40B right in this location, right at the eastern edge of the service area, which is proposed as a 73-unit 40B, and they are constructing that with a package treatment plant. So the options are already there for 40B. We don't think that this will really change the equation whatsoever. The densities that were mentioned by the speaker, I think that's completely out of character and out of scale for Sudbury. My data indicates that densities of approximately 12 units per acre for suburban sewered areas are what the state's guidelines are. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill?
My name is Bill Duckett. I live at 648 Boston Post Road. My driveway is directly across the street from the Bushy property. My place of business is directly across catty corner across from the subject property. Make no mistake, it may not be politically correct to say so, but we're talking about the burden being passed on to the business community. And business community is already burdened by paying a higher tax rate. And when expenses are added on to the business, the consumer ultimately covers that added expense. I think we have a lot of unanswered questions. I'm a little bit disappointed in reading an article in the Town Crier that stated that we, the business people, when there were only 6 or 7 people who put that letter in the paper last week representing a small number of properties on the Boston Post Road. I'm a member of the Sudbury Chamber of Commerce and a former member of the Board of Directors, and I understand the Board of Directors sent a letter and supporting this. But I can tell you that the Chamber did not poll the members to find out how we felt about it. There was a meeting recently with the selectmen and various departments in the town of Sudbury with that same core group of people who own large parcels. And I can understand their feeling that they need some relief at some point. But the smaller businesses were excluded from that and not invited. At least I can speak for myself. I think there are a lot of unanswered questions, and it almost looks like I'm the last person to raise a question. So if that's the case, I would just urge you to not support this article. And as other people have mentioned, maybe there are more questions that need to be answered.
Thank you.
Thank you. Brian?
Brian Semple, 15 River Road. So I'd just like to follow up on the 40B question. So all due respect to our planning department has been traditionally very, very pro 40B, as has many parts of our town government. It's the 40B aspect that concerns me most. I think if we ended up with a thriving commercial district that was helping to go fund the schools with this, I'd be all for that. I am concerned about the 40B development. So maybe two questions. One is, does this allow the Longfellow Glen property, which is significantly underdeveloped, could we add more 40B into that? And then two, if we were to go rebuild, we mentioned the Carriage House Estates, I think it was, what, 16 units on that acreage. If we were to redo that today or in 3 years with septic, could that density now be doubled or tripled?
Is that your question?
That's my question. So two questions, Longfellow Glen, can we add more there? And if we were to redo the Carriage House estates with the sewer in 3 to 4 years. In other words, if we were building that from scratch in 3 to 4 years, what type of density would we get? Could I get someone from the town to answer, please?
You mean an employee?
Not someone from Weston. I appreciate them being here, but I like someone who's part of the town.
Ms. Eggleston is actually a past member of the planning board and on the technical advisory committee.
I am a resident of the town.
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
And a taxpayer.
But actually, could I get someone from the planning or zoning or someone that controls 40B?
Okay, we'll get somebody to answer your question. Jody? I think that's pretty good.
Those are hypothetical questions, clearly. Longfellow Glen, it's a large parcel, as you saw. That's fine, Mark. They are an extremely large user and their flow has been incorporated into the system, 40,000 gallons per day, I believe their system is. Could they be redeveloped? You know, it's hypothetical. I can't really answer that. Carriage Lane, on the other hand, I mean, I don't know if anyone's been there, but there's not a whole lot of land left there, even if they had a sewer. They have a very small front yard. That's where both their wastewater and their stormwater is, it's hardly anything. So I really don't think that you would see much more density there. Does that answer the question?
So my question was, if that was to develop, let's say that was a clean parcel, carriageway, and they were going to develop it in 3 years when there was a sewer in place, would we see a density that was 2x because suddenly there's a sewer in place and they don't need to do the septic?
Well, I just don't think so, just because, you know, the way those structures are along, it's just a linear development. Most of the units face Route 20. Two of the buildings are facing side by side. I know Jeff Clough is itching over there.
Jody, I see that Jeff from the Zoning Board of Appeals is here, and he may also have some.
Every 40B project is evaluated differently, so it's difficult to make any particular determination on that. But if I were to look at a project like the Carriage Lane project, I agree with Jody. I mean, they would be hard-pressed to do much more there. Understand that in some cases there's a balance on the density issue. For example, you know, Longfellow Glen, there's a lot of open space there. Some additional density there might be in the best interest of the town in terms of getting to the 10% level of the affordable housing. So there's always that trade-off if you'd want that. Since I was the one that raised the original question, my question was not whether or not there'd be more or less 40Bs there. As I mentioned when we sort of went down that path, the 40Bs are going to come in where they're going to come in, and they're going to have to be addressed as they're addressed. My concern was that we made sure there was capacity there, because I'd hate to see a system get built that all of a sudden is now over capacity before we use it because we didn't think of this. Many of the larger 40Bs come into town and they build their own wastewater treatment there. So the density, there are other factors that factor into the density issue when it comes to the 40Bs, and whether or not there were sewer there or not would not necessarily impact that. I also spent 10 years on the zoning board in Marlborough that does have sewer, and you know, kind of looking at the difference. The difference in the projects is not typically going to be sewer or not sewer. It's many other factors, rental versus ownership and other things are much greater determinant of densities than sewer versus septic, at least in my experience.
Thank you. We've had quite a few questions. Is there anybody who's got something new to add? Chris, let me hold on 1 second. I'll recognize Bill in the back first. Oh, we have somebody here calling the question. Is there, how many people have something else to say? Raise your cards, please. You have something totally new. Does the hall wish to allow one more comment before we call the question? Yes? All right, all those in favor, raise your cards, please. In favor of allowing Mr. Morley to speak, please raise your cards. And opposed? Okay, Chris.
Thank you, everyone. Chris Morley from the Planning Board. Very short. We've actually just been asked to read a letter from a business owner and town resident who had planned to speak for himself here tonight and was unable to for business reasons, I believe. So I'll read it as quickly as I can. It's from the Katz Irrevocable Trust, 410 Boston Post Road. To residents, property owners, and business owners in the town of Sudbury, I'm writing this letter in favor of and in support of the town of Sudbury's efforts to install a sewer system to enhance the business zone and quality of life along Route 20. I am writing this letter as one who presents as a resident, a property owner, and a business owner in the town. I've been the manager and beneficial owner of the Rugged Bear Plaza since September 8, 1995. For fiscal year 2011, Katz Irrevocable Trust has paid over $67,000 in what I call unencumbered tax dollars. The trust has paid over $750,000 since our initial investment in this property in 1995. I realize that a number of town offices and departments, like police, fire, building, etc., have helped us to operate a safe and friendly business establishment. Nonetheless, the monies we have paid in have helped to pay their salaries to provide great schools and other necessary services with very little return. We are currently looking for a tenant for the old Rugged Bear store premises. We are in conversation with a number of prospective tenants. However, we cannot handle certain business establishments that require larger sewer capacity than our septic system can handle. There may also be sewer limitations that have restricted growth of the growth of our current tenant base. As a resident, it is in my best interest to make sure that we have a thriving and successful business zone that entices me to spend money here in town. A thriving and successful business zone means thriving businesses and properties that ensure that my residential taxes can stay lower than they may have been without them. As a business owner, Charles D. Katz, CPA, I want all the residents in the town to do business conveniently right here. Then I can afford to stay here and pay rent that will eventually be allocated towards the town of Sudbury real estate taxes. I support the town's efforts to install the sewer system. It is an investment from which I will benefit as a resident, as a property owner, and as a business owner. Sincerely, Charles D. Katz, Manager, Katz Irrevocable Trust. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Chris. Do I have a second for the call of the question? We do. Okay, this is a two-thirds vote, remember. Can you put the article back up on the view graph so everybody can, it's there. Okay, so you know what we're voting on. So all those in favor of, right, we're voting on moving the question. Sorry, this is my first time. All those in favor of moving the question, please raise your cards. Opposed? Nobody, we're ready. Okay. Now we are on the motion, main motion. All those in favor of Article 20, please raise your cards. And opposed? It's overwhelmingly two-thirds. It passes. Thank you. And we are now on to Article 21, and Mr. Fox will gladly take over his position. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirsten. We're about to start. Mr. O'Brien will make the motion on Article 21. You may have noticed Mr. O'Brien's seat was empty during the discussion on Article 20. That's because he also had a conflict since he lives in the sewer area. He lives on Boston Post Road.
I guess that goes with being a selectman. You could say I'm full of, okay, we'll go from there.
Right. Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Moderator, in so many ways. We'll move right on to number 21, and we are going to move in the words of the article, except in section 4346, add the words and properties after school buildings. The motion proposed this evening differs from the warrant article in that the Board of Selectmen...
Whoa, sorry.
You got me going, Mr. Moderator.
Can you take a look at the view graph, Larry, and see it?
Do you have the corrected?
Is that the motion that you just made? Or is that a little different?
Yes.
Okay. Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. The motion proposed this evening differs from the warrant article in that the Board of Selectmen is recommending that towers be prohibited on school properties as well as school buildings. During the public hearing, it was brought to our attention that we did not definitively lay that out, so we wanted to add those words to clearly indicate that properties and buildings would be excluded, along with town-owned cemeteries. No other changes from the warrant have been made. So what you have in front of you, with the exception of these minor changes, is what we'll be discussing this evening. This is an article that is a follow-up to the Planning Board article that I stood here in 1998 and presented to all of you, and this was in the advent of the 1996 adoption of the Federal Telecommunications Act, and that act essentially set out the ground rules for the construction of cell phone towers, monopoles, et cetera, across the nation. And from 1998 to now, I think it's safe to say that the devices we had in our pockets were relatively simple. And while I was lounging in the back of the hall, I noticed that people are enjoying the wireless services on their iPads and iPhones and Blackberries, et cetera. So the reason I raise that is that the demand for infrastructure and cell phone towers has grown tremendously. There is just an insatiable demand for towers to go up, and we seem to constantly be getting requests through the planning office for sites and locations. The parcels that were approved originally by this body in 1998, and if we can put that map up, are indicated here, and everything that you see that is of the dark red or brown color are sites that are in the original article. Thank you, Jody. And out of all of those sites, they are currently occupied. There is one site that is available that we will be developing an RFP on, and that's by the DPW barn. And there is another site that has construction has not begun but has been approved for a tower down in the Water District on the Raymond Road area. The need for adding additional sites to the overlay district was originally recognized a year and a half ago. An article, as you may recall, was put forth last year and then withdrawn by the Planning Board because it had a series of sites on it that, through the public hearing process, received a lot of feedback from residents that they were less than desirable and people were not supportive of them. One of the primary sites that was on that list was right here on the grounds of Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School. So that site has been withdrawn from the list. We have revised the article to include town-owned properties. Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School is its own independent principality and therefore is not considered a town-owned property and is not part of the list. What brought this to the selectmen's attention this year is that since we have conducted a coverage site, a coverage analysis, and where the soft spots are and where there's a lack of coverage, if we can go to this map, this was put together by, as cell towers have been approved, we have collected some additional funds that we've used to do this analysis, and essentially the chart indicates that anything in the gray area is poor coverage. Anything in the red-brown area is very good coverage. And the other two colors are somewhere in between. And the cell companies continue to come in and say that depending on which company it is, out of all the available services that are out there, that they need to have additional sites. And they very much prefer to work in an environment where they are not going to receive a lot of pushback from the town. Now, the sites that we have, as we showed on the other map, have been used. And if we don't add more sites, we're going to run into a situation that has occurred a couple of times already, and that is that while no particular application has gone all the way through to final approval, there have been some preliminary applications submitted for cell towers to be located on private property in neighborhood areas within town. This is completely allowable and permissible under the federal regulations, which essentially say that you cannot block the siting of towers due to aesthetic reasons, health reasons, and or location reasons. So if the person sitting to your right or left or behind you or in front of you has a piece of property that might be in one of these colored areas that is appealing to one of these companies, and they find someone who might be interested in having a 100-foot monopole in their backyard and a small service shed for the equipment that that provides a signal to that tower, you could conceivably find that a contract has been signed and one of those is popping up in your neighborhood. When one of the sites, Victoria Road, came up as a site that was under consideration, I can tell you that my land-based telephone, along with my cellular telephone, were both ringing quite a bit from people who wanted to know how this could be fought or blocked or prohibited. If we can put up the last slide, Mark. This is a list of the town-owned parcels that we're proposing, and we are proposing, and I understand that there's going to be a amendment brought by the Zoning Board who reviewed this article, and the Board of Selectmen is in support of that amendment. If you read the article in your warrant, it says that by right we would allow towers of 80 feet. The Zoning Board is going to bring a proposal, an amendment that will require that the application go through the special permit process, and the Board of Selectmen is fine with that. What I would like to do is just review each of the revised sections that residents understand what we are proposing with these changes, and if you are looking to follow along, it's on page 15 of your warrant. Essentially what this does is clarifies the language of section 4330, said no change to the intent of the bylaw. And number two, we're removing several unbuildable parcels of land on Raymond Road. These parcels are within 400 feet of the Sudbury Water District wells and cannot be developed. Section 4334 still contains a buildable parcel in this area, which has recently been approved for a tower that I had previously mentioned. Minor changes in the language to require site plan review if additional equipment, buildings, or cabinets are added. And number four, this is the largest change to the existing bylaw, which is to allow 80-foot cell towers. As I said, this is going to be amended in a moment, so I will skip over that. Section 5, 4363 presently requires large setback for cell towers, 500 feet from a residential lot line and 1,000 feet from a school building. Proposing to remove these setbacks as they may be challengeable in court, these setbacks were inserted in the original bylaw back in 1998, and almost no cell tower meets these setbacks, and they have routinely been waived by the ZBA during the permitting process. Removing them to make our bylaw more legally defensible is, we think, a better approach at this time as we update this bylaw. Number six, minor changes in the language to clarify a permitting requirement for photos of the site. And I would just bring to your attention that this has been a substantial revenue producer for the town over the last 10 years that this bylaw has been in place. We have collected in excess of $1.25 million over that time period, and the revenue continues to come in on a regular basis. And the other thing that I would say is that when you think of town-owned parcels and you look at that list that was up there, some of those sites, a reference point that I would give you to think about is that in Southborough Town Center, they have a large, handsome flagpole, and that is a revenue-producing flagpole for the town of Southborough because it operates as a cell tower with a large American flag hanging off of it. So with that, the Board of Selectmen embraces and welcomes the amendment that the ZBA is going to offer, and we urge your support for purposes of potentially generating new revenue for the town as we move towards continuing to try and hit our target of self-sustainability, as well as to protecting the character of our neighborhoods and having the benefit of being able to site these towers on town-owned properties rather than having to fight amongst ourselves if they start to appear in neighborhoods. Thank you for your consideration, and we appreciate your support.
FinCom.
Finance Committee recommends approval.
And Eric Polk for the Planning Board.
Thank you. The Planning Board supports this article. We've been working with the Selectmen on this for the last 12 years and would like to ensure the same level of success over the last 13 years that gets continued into the next decade. I feel strongly that if Sudbury does not take action to increase the numbers of available sites for cell tower location, we will very likely see them in places where we do not want them. As Larry stated, under the 1996 Federal Telecommunications Act, wireless facilities can be installed anywhere and trump local zoning controls. What we experienced in the 13 years of legislation has taught us is that if you provide zoning districts where they are allowed, most companies will locate there and avoid the cost and time of a lawsuit. However, if you do not create such districts, they will almost always win on appeal, and this has proven itself to be the case across the country time and time again, and is a very costly way to do business. Sudbury has always prided itself on being proactive rather than reactive, and this issue is case in point. We were at the forefront of zoning for wireless facilities and have benefited from this. We have 12 cell towers in town now, and most of them are completely invisible. The town collects over $130,000 each year from leases on two town properties, and the water district benefits similarly. But more carriers want to enter the market, and there are known coverage gaps in different parts of town. They will be trying to fill them. If we don't provide adequate coverage on legally zoned sites, they will locate them where they need to. For more in-depth information on this, you can look to the Planning Board town website and find the local coverage study that was commissioned by the town, which is the guidance for which this proposed article is brought before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Hang on. And we just need your name.
Frank Lyons, 157 Wayside Inn Road. If you look at the wording of the article in Section 1, it says the wire services overlay district. I believe that should be overlay.
Wonderful. We'll include that in the amendment. Thank you. Mr. Clough, can you come here, please? And can we put Mr. Clough's amendment up there? Okay, why don't you stay right there, Mr. Clough?
Okay.
If everyone will turn to page 16 in your warrant and look at number 4.
Hang on.
And what Mr. Clough is about to say in number 4 is where it says 4346, there's words in the second line, freestanding monopoles which are no higher than 80 feet. You're proposing to strike those words?
That's correct.
So why don't you start with I move?
Okay, but I just want to clarify one point. First, for the record, Jeffrey Clough, 15 Ironworks Road. I come here, I offer this amendment. Wait,
you got to make the amendment first.
I'll make the amendment first. Okay, so I move that we amend Article 21, Number 4, by striking the words freestanding monopoles, which are no higher than 80 feet from the text. And you want me to you were going to add the other one?
Yes. And let's see, I just have to find the right section here. Section 1, it's changed the word overlay to overlay. That's also part of his amendment.
Okay. So first, a small point.
Does that amendment receive a second? It's okay. All yours.
So first, a small point of clarification. Selectman O'Brien may have led you to believe I come here representing the Zoning Board of Appeals. While I'm a member of the board, I come here representing my own opinion as an independent citizen. I'm recommending that we strike this language from from this particular section of the bylaw. There's another section that allows for a special permit process, that's section 4350, that will allow these poles, but will move them through the special permit process. The special permit process will allow the zoning board to review these applications to determine things such as appropriate placement, potential multi-tenancy of these poles so that multiple carriers can take advantage of the same poles, looking at the placement of those poles in terms of keeping them as visually invisible as possible, and potentially for some of these designs, making sure that issues around structural integrity are there, and that if there's concerns around those, that those issues are addressed and the poles are reviewed every 10 to 15 years or whatever is deemed appropriate. By removing it from this section will not stop the poles from being there. It will just keep them going through the process, the special permit process, and allow some review of those.
Anybody wish to be heard on this amendment? Let's start off with that, and then we'll move on. Yes, Mr. Coe.
This may be what they're conferring about there, but I noticed that the word cemeteries is still in the, where it says the resulting number four will read as follows, but I think that word cemeteries got replaced with the word properties in the original motion.
No, the word cemetery right? is on that fourth to bottom line at the end.
So this is not the one that got changed? I guess not.
I don't understand. What do you got?
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that, please?
Apparently I'm in error. I thought that the original motion, that Mr. O'Brien said the original motion had replaced the word cemeteries with properties, and now it appears that's not the case.
Mr. Moderator, Mr. Coe, we added the word properties in reference to school buildings. So it's school buildings and school properties will not have monopole towers.
It's school buildings and properties.
And properties.
And cemeteries. So you're okay with those words, is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. Coe, you all set? Okay. We all set? No change? Wonderful. Okay, so now anybody else wish to be heard on Mr. Clough's two amendments? The one that's just eliminating from 4346 the words freestanding monopoles, which are no higher than 80 feet, and adding an A to the overly to make it overlay in section one, as Mr. Lyons pointed out. Can we get a mic right there? We're just talking about the amendment right now.
Right. This is Matt Copeland, 17 Oak Ridge Road. I just want to make sure I understand. Is by removing the monopole reference from this section, does that take away the protection of the school buildings and properties?
I mean, we'd probably check with town council, but my answer would be no. That all we've done is we've in some ways made this tighter rather than looser, right? But before that, in addition to the restrictions on the schools and the cemeteries, they could have, by right, without going through the special permit process, put up a monopole on town property. Now they would have to go through the special permit process.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on the amendment? Yes, Jody.
Jody Kavler, Director of Planning and Community Development. Sorry, Jeff, I don't think I am set with this. I don't think that this does what we intended it to. The intent that the Planning Board and the Board of Selectmen worked on was that cell towers, could be put on town-owned properties. And that would, again, be by RFP of the land by the Selectmen. Town Council has not looked at this, and I don't think that this has that same effect. I think that this is actually going to limit cell installations to only roof or facade-mounted equipment on town-owned properties, and that really wasn't the intent. I urge defeat of this.
Yes.
Robin Gunderson, 95 Fox Run. I'm just wondering where the other boards stand on this. Like, where does the zoning
board stand? Since you were speaking as an individual.
We have a gentleman from the zoning board, if we can get a mic over to him. Over there, back that way. Could you stand up, please?
The zoning board generally does not...
Excuse me, oh, I just need a name and address.
Of course. Beth Quirk, 20 Scottswood Drive. The zoning board generally does not take positions on the floor of town meeting because we are essentially an adjudicatory body that has to then enforce or make decisions based on bylaws as the town determines the bylaws to be. So I really don't think the zoning board, having not concurred on any of this, can take any position. This is Mr. Clough's idea as a private citizen. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Before we vote, Mr. Clough, do you want to have some more words with Ms. Cadillac while we wait? If you do that quickly, and then maybe we can come to a resolution of those issues. Yes, Mr. Morley.
Chris Morley, Planning Board. Speaking for myself, though, we haven't concurred on this. They're going to work out whether it works, and there it disappeared. But I'm not a lawyer. I had a serious concern that just if you read what it is in the warrant and you read what's up there is not well written. It's poor legal wording. I don't think it's clear to whoever is going to have to adjudicate, Beth, the way it's written now. Which doesn't mean that Mr. Clough couldn't rewrite it in a better way, but I don't like the way it's written.
Well, so are you talking about Mr. O'Brien's original motion, or
no.
You talk as rewritten by...
As rewritten, I believe in the process of adding and excising, it got muddy.
Great. You join that conversation over there. Okay, we can make this conversation bigger if anyone else wants to join in. Excuse me, could you stand up, please?
Thank you. As of now...
I need a name and address.
Sorry, Carol Wolf, 637 Concord Road. As of now, I believe when a cell tower is proposed, it has to go before the Zoning Board of Appeals for a special permit. Is that correct?
Zoning Board, is that correct? Yes.
Okay. So what isn't shown up here is that this, I believe, would change the bylaw, the town bylaw, that it would be as of right an 80-foot pole could be put on any town property.
Let me try to get that question answered. No. Can I just get that answered?
Yes.
Mr. O'Brien.
Yes. The discussion that's taking place over there is looking to... address the point that's being made over here, which is to move the by right, to remove the language by right, and to, I believe, move it back into a special permit application process. I believe what they're discussing is the fact that by removing the word monopole, you may be limiting the type of structures, cellular structures that could be erected to those that might sit on rooftops only. And I would suspect that that's what they're trying to clarify.
Ms. Wolf, did you have a further comment?
Well,
question?
Yes. I would support a motion that removes the as of right, because that means that it would cell companies would have as of right the ability to put a cell tower on town property without going for a special permit. So I hope that the intent of removing the as of right by right it remains removed from the article. I think it's very important that the ZBA is allowed to review all cell tower permit applications.
And Ms. Wolf, that's what they're trying to discuss right now. And as soon as that they're done, we'll report to you.
Right. So I'm saying that I'm in support of that, and okay. I think it is a beneficial for the town that is the way it is understood. Thank
very,
you.
Very good. Anybody? Yes, right here.
Robert Abrams, 48 Horse Pond Road. I have a different question while that's being debated, Mr. Moderator. It has to do with one of the slides Mr. O'Brien put up with a list of properties. And in the selectman's report in the warrant, it says only those parcels deemed suitable for such installation will be authorized by the Board of Selectmen. And I'd like it clarified, is the list that was put on the view graph those properties which the selectmen have determined to be suitable, or are the selectmen going to determine from that list which of those properties are suitable?
Mr. O'Brien.
Neither, Mr. Abrams.
Thank you.
The list is a suggested list of potential sites to give the town a sampling of where cell towers might potentially be put out on RFP for a cell tower to be located. But since the town, as you know, owns numerous parcels, many of which are underwater or too small or not suitable for a cell tower, we did not want to try and indicate that with dots on a map or a list. Substantial parcels like the ones indicated would be the ones that the Board of Selectmen would give consideration to.
Okay, so they haven't already been determined to be suitable. Are there any from that list that the board has already determined to be suitable?
No, but many of those sites have come up in conversations with cell companies that come in and they either ask the question one of two ways: we would like to put a cell tower here, is that possible? And currently they're not in our overlay district, so we try and dissuade them from that and drive them towards a current parcel in the current zoning bylaw. Or they come in and they ask the other way, which is, we would like to place one here. Can we do that? So by expanding the district, when cell companies came in and said, we have a zone or an area where we're soft, where can we place towers? What's in your overlay district? We could direct them to some of these parcels. And then if it looked like one was suitable, we would put it out for an RFP.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we get to any more questions, I think we've reached an accommodation between Mr. Moore, Mr. Clough, and Ms. Kablak, and you will see it right now. So, am I correct in assuming, Mr. Clough, that you wish to withdraw your amendment?
I will.
And whoever made the second over here is withdrawing that second. We no longer have Mr. Clough's amendment, either one of them. Now, Ms. Kablak wishes to make an amendment.
Should I read that?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Amend Article 21, number 4 as follows. Remove freestanding monopoles which are no higher than 80 feet. The resulting number 4 will now read as follows. Section 4336, on all property and buildings exclusive of school buildings and properties and cemeteries. That we're not removing.
Jody, keep reading it while he's typing.
Exclusive of school buildings and properties and cemeteries. No, I can't continue reading it.
Jody?
My mistake.
Jody? Yes.
Okay.
She hasn't finished her amendment. Let me finish that, get a second, and then we'll get to you.
Section 4336, on all property and buildings owned by the town of Sudbury, exclusive of school buildings and properties and cemeteries, and to correct in Section 4330, the spelling of overly to overlay.
Hang on one second. There it is there.
There's an extra period after 10.
It'd be a comma, Jody?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Mark, can you make that a comma? after the word Sudbury. And then, that's fine.
Hang on a minute. Hang on. Are you all set, Jody?
Yes.
Does that receive a second? It does. She first gets to talk about her amendment and why she's making it. And yes.
Comma? Town of Sudbury,
the
comma.
Period.
Exclusive.
Oh, no, this better be good.
No, the what? Section number is correct. That's what we changed. That's the whole change. Mr. Clough's amendment, and I believe that his majority of his issue was that these towers should not be allowed by right. And they were in Section 4346 because that is the section, 4340 is installations allowed by right. So when that's really what we wanted to take out. We needed to move this into Section 4330, which are installations allowed by special permit. So this is now the last parcel in that list, which currently contains 4331 is the Sudbury landfill, 4332 is the former Malone property on North Road, 4333 is the Water District borrow pit, 4334 is the Raymond Road wellfield, 4335 is the Highway Department, and now 4336 says all property and buildings owned by the town of Sudbury, exclusive of school buildings and properties and cemeteries. And I urge your support of this.
Now, Jody, so this means an answer to Ms. Wolf's question that this is no longer by right. This will be special permit.
Correct.
Thank you. There was a question over there. Somebody? Yes, could you stand up, please? Laura, excuse me. They gave the mic to someone else. I'll get you next. Go ahead.
Carolyn Lee, 28 Mossman Road. Without intending any disrespect to anybody, why do we exclude cemeteries?
Why don't we or why do we?
Why do we exclude them?
Why do we... Jody, why do we exclude cemeteries?
In discussions with the selectmen, they just felt that that was a more reflective area and they did not want cell tower installations on those properties.
Okay. Ms. Abrams? Yep.
Well, if we're trying to come to the end, I was just going to ask if this is going to continue, would it be inappropriate to have them resolve this overnight and bring it up for us thing tomorrow? Thank you.
You would rather do that? Okay. Did I hear you, Laura, say move to adjourn to tomorrow at 7:30?
I move to adjourn tomorrow at 7:30.
We will
being the first
take
article.
Up this article first.
Thank
of business.
You.
Okay. All those in favor? Is there a second? All those in favor? All those opposed? Wonderful idea. Thank you. By the way, this is a perfect example why you don't want to amend zoning articles on town meeting floor.